Right, we're here for another episode of Snake and Banter with me and Maui. And our guest for this one is Alan Hender, who actually, as I was just discussing before the show started, we were somewhat remiss that we never had him on a past episode. We've had like every other person basically almost ever touch the microphone and, parentheses, didn't flame me on Twitter before they became famous. So when I say that, like, that's a society thing. That's actually not the main thing that'll ruin your whole career if you ever do that to me ever. But obviously, we're going to make up for that now because we have got Alan with us now. So, obviously, Alan, we do operate what I call the Fight Club rule, which is the guest always has to start first, just like in Fight Club, you had to fight if it was your first night, you know. So what is your good point that you're bringing to the table for us here? What is yours on this one?
So the good point is, it's about Vitality and their roster move post-major to get Flames in, but it's more so focusing on actually kind of the Bulls to do that
right
after winning OAJ, okay, after being one of the best teams in the world.
Right. Oh, by the way, but I also should have mentioned Alan obviously was a former coach of Endpoint and worked on many broadcasts, including like IM Rio Major, etc. If people saw it. Right. On that angle, so specifically for people who don't get it, this isn't about is Flames good or was Dupree bad. It's more about the idea that like you have just won the major, but you're still willing to make, in theory, an upgrade or make a change, right? So go on then, lay it out there. Why are you so impressed with this, or what's the big deal about this for you?
It's because we see so few people do it, and it's maybe indicative of a lack of really good management or good GMs, but how often do you see a team get into that position, win a huge tournament, and then actually be able to stand back, have the perspective to say, we could make an upgrade here. We could upgrade a player, and it's also the idea that when you win a big event or these sort of things, that's when you're at your absolute highest in terms of attracting players, or maybe even financially, especially after winning a major, bringing in sponsors, sticking money, all that. So combine it all together. We don't see it often, but in the case of Vitality, and there has been other teams, you know, the team that Verts Pro Outsiders also with Norbert, these are teams that looked at their lineups and said, we could make an upgrade here, and to actually have the balls to do it is quite amazing. Obviously, Vitality's in pretty good form, so yeah, I'm impressed, and I wish we saw more teams actually have the nuts to make a move like that.
Okay, right, come on then, Maui. Obviously, he's given quite a specific set of parameters there, but it's an interesting take.
Yeah, I was gonna bring up the whole fact that it's funny that Outsiders sort of did the same thing by bringing in Chiron for Norbert, since of course they have kicked Chiron. And they've actually brought Norbert back for Kickert. So that's kind of a funny way that they went about their sort of roster changes. But with Vitality, I would say that a lot of people... Well, I would say this. I would say I myself, when the move happened, was pretty excited to see that they had the foresight to recognize the future is not probably going to be as bright if you keep Dupree on the roster. And so for them to be as forward-thinking as they have been, bring on an up-and-comer like Flames, who I would say many of us knew was good. I'd say that I liked Flames' gameplay a lot because I just love how active he is as a player. And in today's meta, it seems like you do need to be incredibly active. You have to make a lot of plans. You have to know that if something happens on the other side of the map even, you should probably do something on your side to make up for whatever happened there. And Flames, to me, has been a player ever since he really joined OG that he was going to be a guy that was always taking the initiative. I always remember when he was playing pretty much like the first couple games with them, that he would be at the corner of Banana all the time, just kind of like top car area, and just always looking, if he's on CT side, like looking to flash somebody in, looking to get flashed in, and making sure that he can always upset the opponent's timings. And it feel like he was a very disruptive player. Whereas Dupree, kind of one of the big problems for Vitality when they were first integrating Majisk and Dupree is in some ways how passive those two were compared to the more active nature of the Vitality players. And they were eventually able to make it work in order to win a couple of tournaments. But in a lot of ways, it felt like Dupree was only getting his form up for that one big tournament. And in a lot of ways, I wasn't going to expect him to continue that moving on. And so for them to actually be as active in their roster moves as they have been and to bring in Flames, I was very much so a fan of. And I also think that there were so many people when they lost that first tournament with Flames at Cologne, where they finally, when they didn't, that were saying like the 2020 hindsight was in full effect. Everybody's like, why did they kick Dupree? Why did they kick Dupree? But it's like, God, it's just like, you guys just wait a little bit and it's going to be better. And they've already proven that that can be the case with a tournament like Gamers 8.
The funny thing is, the reason why I actually think it's quite a brave point that Alan brings up, not even literally just doing the, like, I think Flames is better than other one, but specifically, like, the point of gambling on a potential upgrade after you basically are number one in the world. The reason why I think that's quite a brave point is I actually don't think most fans would agree with you, Alan. Maybe now they do specifically because the Flames move looks good and they were a fan of him. But I actually think most fans would go the opposite way, because when Maui's saying that, the first thing I think of is what a nightmare last year was with G2 and Vitality fans telling us they should never have made the big roster moves and they should have kept those 2021 lineups where they had like the scoffed Misuta one and Kyojin, and then G2 had like Nexa and fucking Jax and Amanek. Like, just because on paper those teams had better results. You know, fans spent all last year being like, why didn't they just keep that lineup? Even though, and this is one of the points I'm going to make, the other reason why you upgrade and make changes when it's the right time to cynically do it is because you're not playing the same teams anymore. Like, a key point I would make is this. The reason why you also, essentially, it's not even about win or lose. You should always, as a team, be looking for potential real upgrades. I actually did a video where that was the title, but the key point I made was it has to be a real upgrade. It can't just be on paper, this looked like it'd be awesome. It has to be like, you know, this guy would bring what we need to go to another level or make us more dangerous. The reason why that's key to me is because I've always thought there's an interesting meta in Counter-Strike that people ignore, which is how people recruit players. And my observation from years ago is most of the other really good teams actually seem to recruit, or it's, I don't know if they do it consciously, but it seems like if you look at the outcome, to specifically make their team powerful enough to beat the number one team. So if you essentially win tournaments, unless you already have an absurdly, like, all-time great lineup, you already should be looking for an upgrade, because the difference is, I'm sure the team that comes third or fourth, they are out there in the world picking up a really good player or kicking out their worst player because they haven't had the results. So over time, essentially, you can't just sit statically because the other teams are changing, they're upgrading, they're trying to make themselves more dangerous or counter whatever you bring to the team. It's like I've always said this, when we came back to LAN and that Na'Vi lineup just beat everyone and only lost the one series and won all those LANs in 2021, notice every other top team just recruited like all the aimers. They were, because essentially what they looked at Na'Vi and they were like, right, the real problem here is, even if you get everything else sorted, you can't beat the firepower. They're too good. They've got Prime Simple. This big guy's cracked. So everyone went for these big, like, superstar upgrades. So that's another reason why I actually think, I mean, I said this before, I don't know if Flames is specifically like the permanent upgrade, but the actual move I totally agreed with for exactly that reason. I actually think if they'd have stuck with what they had, like, essentially what you have to pray for then is, one, all the other roster moves don't make the other teams better and help them catch up. And then two, you're also praying that, like, you can hit that peak level again. Like, the other reason why the Dupree one specifically I thought was a great cut is because I thought it was, like, I actually think they did him a favor there, mate. I think he's lucky he hasn't even played a game of CS since, like, the Major and then that Blast. Because if he'd have just played these last few events and been average on some other team, this wouldn't even be a discussion. We wouldn't even be having this convo. Like, I don't buy that he could have maintained the form he had at those tournaments where they got it going. The Blast one, the IEM, Rio, and the Major. I actually think he might have even overperformed in some of those games. I think that looked even almost like a honeymoon of the switch the positions up. I even think personally, if I had to be cynical, because they won't say this in an interview, I even suspect they switched it up. It sort of worked, but the fact it only sort of worked, like his different roles, made them just think, why don't we just get a young player who can do this, who's got all the skills and doesn't have like any of the downside of being really old and having played a different style and being more important. Like, I think it actually, unfortunately, even though it brought him success to pre, I think it exposed that he didn't really have anything more. Like, I think he gave everything. So I think it's a great move. If people don't know, the actual sports coach who taught me that this is an amazing approach is Bill Belichick of the New England Patriots. Because if people don't know, this is a guy who has been insanely ruthless like this. In fact, he has a famous line that is a principle where he says, it is better to cut them 1 year early than 1 year late. Now, I actually think, again, that is incredibly brave to even explicitly say you're doing that. Because everyone else does the opposite. Everyone, every other great coach and team leader waits until the team clearly doesn't work anymore and then they make the hard cuts. And the other reason, by the way, why that's also not that great an approach is because when you do it after the bad results come, you also now are devalued as a team. You're not as attractive a place to go to play anymore because your team's got problems. The other reason why the Vitality move is gangster is because, like, look, remember, there is a world where they actually had their choice. They could have gotten a bigger name than this if they want. As far as I know, the interviews imply they did it because he didn't have a buyout, and so it was also just like, it made sense, like money wise and stuff. The other reason why it's gangster is everyone wants to join the team that just won the major, mate. It's also actually, in a way, even though it feels, you feel BM kicking a guy out your team, it's also when your team's the most attractive, though. There's a ton of people out there who would love to get that fifth spot, especially if they actually think they're good at the game. So I actually think when we look back in history, whether they win the next major or not, I actually think this will be an example of, like, I hope what the new meta is for recruiting for teams. Because I actually am a bit sick of those great teams. It's basically every other all-time great team in history did this. They just hang on to that five-man lineup till the bitter end. In fact, some of them even have the gall to, like, make those lineups again, like, a year later or something. So I would actually say this does go counter to most philosophy. It even makes me wonder, because he hasn't really talked about this part, just didn't have good interviews like me putting the questions to him. The real question that everyone needs to ask Zonic isn't, why did he make this move? I would ask him this. Did your experiences in Astralis inform why you made this, like, really quick move after a roster move? Like, for example, did you hold on to the old lineup too long, or did you think you could make it work? I would love to know if that's what's sort of changed his philosophy over the years. But no, I agree with the central point. I think it's almost inarguably good that they actually had the balls to do it. Again, not every one of these moves will work, but I thought it was great. Anyway, speaking of knowing appropriately when to apply and use flames, here's the thing. If you wanted to warm or heat something or set it on fire, then it'd be absolutely vital, necessary, invaluable in some ways to have flames. But when it comes to enjoying cannabis products, I don't want too much heat. I don't want scalding, burning smoke in my lungs. I'll put up with it if I have to. But if I have the choice not to, like, for example, if I went to thefreezepipe.com and then used the code LFN for 10% off any of their selection of bongs, bobblers, oils, and dab rigs, then I could enjoy cannabis products and THC and other cannabinoids. That's right, nerds. There's more out there. Go look up the temperatures that they all release at. Then I would be able to enjoy it, but without the annoyance of the irritating smoke, because the freeze pipe has a food-safe glycerin chamber that you put in the freezer section for a mere hour, and then it cools smoke by over 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which Alan doesn't even know what that means, or even when it's relevant. Well, to him, is that jet fuel? Is that actually Antarctic temperature? Who knows? Don't worry, Alan. I also don't know what Fahrenheit is or the conversion rate, but I trust that it's a lot colder because it's minus 200. And so obviously, speaking of things that are a lot colder, how about how awesome this product is? Isn't it cool? I believe in the hip-hop community, they say that's cold, when actually they mean that's really cool, which is also when they say that's flames. So again, I'm confused. It's like I'm the boomer in the 90s now, like, well, wait a minute, you kids, is it bad or is it good? And how can it be the shit if it's actually good? I'm that guy, basically. I'm like some guy watching a soap opera. So anyway, thank you to the Freeze Pipe, 10% off with the code LFN at the Freeze Pipe. Right, that's enough of that. That's the end of the commercial. Now we're back into it. Okay, let's go now to Maui's good point. It's a bit of a generic one, but come on, I want to see what angle you go with on this one. Come on.
Yeah, well, so my something I'm excited about with CS2 actually is the fact that the matchmaking system is already legitimately way better than what it was in CSGO. There's two things in particular that I really like about it, having played CS2 for a couple of days with the new way that they're structuring it. The first is that they're using this premier mode, which basically means that the way it's like you queue 5v5 and you. The first team bans two maps, the second team bans three maps, and then the first team that banned two maps gets to ban the final map, and then the next team gets to pick what side they want to start on. And so what this does is it exposes people that play matchmaking to a more competitive replica of what it actually would be like to be playing a best of one in a competitive way. And so it means that people that play CS2 are going to be, if this is what they're going to keep moving forward with, it means that you actually can't queue only Dust2, because I know a lot of people that were my casual friends that would only play Dust2, and then that of course moved on to Mirage, and then they pretty much just only got good at those couple of maps. And I think that this forces people to get out of their comfort zone a little bit more, because this is really, it's almost like people in Valorant, for example, you don't even know what map you're queuing for. So it forces everybody to play every map so that when you actually consume the broadcast product or the esport for that matter, you're more familiar with it if you had played the game at all. So it's in some ways the turnover rate or that's going to be improved in terms of, like, some people are going to watch pro CS. Sometimes they're going to be like, oh, I don't really know this map. And then it feels like the adoption rate is much slower because people just don't play it. And I think that Faceit, Leadify, a couple of those type of companies showed that It is there is a huge skew towards people just playing Mirage and Inferno. Like it's just like people just want to play the same maps over and over again. And I'm sure that's going to be the case in the CS2 Premier mode, but sometimes you're not going to get the map you want, and you because you can't choose it because you're at the whim of your opponents, you're at the whim of your teammates sometimes who are voting. And so that's one benefit. The other thing that I think that they did, which was really nice, is that they made a leaderboard, and it was like, come on, why did it take so long to do this? Because for such a long time, people were just fighting to get global elite. And given that so many people have achieved that in their lives at some point, then there's just doesn't really feel like there's any incentive to play matchmaking. But the fact that now they're putting a worldwide rank on, and I think they might be giving you a percentile as well, but either way, they're giving you a worldwide rank at the very least, and it's showing how many games you played, your win rate on them, and that gives you something to aspire to more, because there's a world number one now in the CS2 matchmaking leaderboard, and that's something that is really cool to see, because when you think about things like League of Legends with the Challenger system, and you think about Valorant with the Radiant system, that actually ends up also having some conversion rate where people eventually from those matchmaking services end up trying to go pro. They try to play tier 2 pro, end up trying to play tier 1 pro. And there's actually a couple people that, like, I think that, I'm not sure, I think it might be that Demon One guy that just won the Valorant World Championship, kind of came from that system. I don't think he really had a very strong...
I believe he wasn't a proper pro before. He even played Unreal Tournament or something. But I think he was very new to Valorant when he got into the team, as far as I know, yeah.
Exactly. So having people who can top the leaderboards, assuming they aren't cheating, like that's the one thing where it's like there might still be cheaters because I don't know if Vax is still perfect, but if assuming that person is legitimately getting to that rank, and the thing is, a lot of pros are now pretty interested in it.
Right.
That can lead to some sort of conversion rate where we might get some casual players end up becoming pros, and one thing that again, like connecting these two ideas, the thing is that. Because they had to play all 7 maps in the active duty pool to get that rank, they couldn't just spam Mirage to get to world number one rank. So there's a greater likelihood that the people that are actually topping the leaderboard can in some way contribute to a competitive environment. It's still a long ways away. You would probably want to take someone from FPLC or FPL before matchmaking, of course, but I'm saying that the roadmap's there for a person now.
Yeah. But I think the kind of the overarching kind of narrative or a lot of these moves behind Valve are essentially bringing what competitive looks like closer to the casual landscape and making it more applicable and more transferable. And the thing I've liked most about practically all the moves is that for so long and in so many other games, when they skew towards the casuals, they bring everything down. Whereas with a lot of these changes, they're bringing the baseline up. And all of these changes are getting players to play more maps or to get used to, you know, presumably with the rank system, you're going to play better players rather than the average global, which, you know, as Maui knows, compared to, you know, any player at a reasonable level isn't particularly good. So I think all of these changes are very good for that. And I think, you know, in terms of like the long-term future and the health of the game, as much as things like Face It and ESEA in the past, as good as they have been, every barrier you add for a new player or someone new to the scene in terms of getting into it and getting used to playing and then moving up through the leaderboards and then playing in teams, every barrier you add means you lose a few players or you have a few players that don't want to make that jump or someone didn't even know how to, perhaps, even if they've, you know, played a lot of the game. Maybe they're just not aware of, you know, what ESEA was a few years ago, so they never played an Open and never got into it. So I think all of these changes are moving in that direction. And for the long-term health of the scene, you will get more players coming through. You will get more players being spotted. And, you know, as Maori's saying, maybe these players don't jump into being full-time professionals, but, you know, if you're just playing in your Open team and you just need some, like, nuts aimer, maybe you will go on this leaderboard and grab the most crack kid from your region or something. So I welcome a lot of the changes. I do like a lot of what Valve has done so far. And I think this is the right philosophy to push the base level game in a direction that when you do get as high as you can in there, it is roughly transferable to the next level, whether that be the ESEA leagues or whatever. So yeah, they're all good changes. And I do think it's going to produce more top players. It should, in the end, might take 10 years, produce a better top scene because of it.
Yeah, the weirdest thing to me, actually, by the way, when you think about it, is it's actually so weird they ever allowed you to pick and unpick maps and then queue up for what? Matchmaking? Like, what? Like, if you don't know the analogy, I would get it if it was like in League of Legends where you have, like, normals mode that isn't ranked and you basically just play a game and it puts you with people roughly about your elo on there and then you just play a game that essentially doesn't matter. You're explicitly saying that this is just a fun game. That's why it's called normals. I would get it if they had a mode like that that's for noobs and then they only want to play a Mirage or just do, like, we're talking about cash. And then they just pick that and then they queue and they get dropped with other noobs and you just play a random game. The idea that was ever matchmaking and you could just take out all the tricky maps like Overpass and then just never play it, but then you could be called global. That was all, that's always been weird to me. It's another reason why if you don't know, if you're a casual fan, nobody has ever valued being global elite, because we all knew from literally the beginning of the game. I mean, the best is if you people like us in the talent world, you literally only have to be friends, not even with a pro mate, with a semi-pro, and you can just, Anders Bloom has done this about 50 times, you can just be boosted like literally to global elite immediately. Because the reason why I say semi-pro is because people don't know how good like online just semi-pros are. Like Anders would just get some kid you've never even heard of, he's never even played in a pro game, but he's just like some Swedish 19-year-old kid and it's 2 a.m. and he's one of those vampires that hits every deagle shot from the entire map and just like the joke is on the four spies, he beats their whole team. Like, you just play with a guy like that for like 3 weeks and spoil it, you are now global elite. Welcome. You didn't do anything in the meantime, by the way. And in this scenario, Anders didn't like, you know, himself like grind or he just played in the team with that. And then he just, as long as the system doesn't put like 4 mega players against him, he just eventually you just win enough games and you get to be global elite. I mean, spoiler, James Bardolph has been global elite. Case closed. Like, enough said, right? So, but in the past, the worst thing is global elite. I know a lot of people in league used to get lost in this. It didn't mean challenger. Like, even when you could do like boosting and ranking stuff in that, no one was getting to challenger who was a bomb in those games. Like, those ladders were fairly sturdy in like League of Legends, and in Dota they have the elo system. Again, if you get to like 7 or 8K elo, you are just a fucking amazing player. Like, you might not be actual like pro, like you might not know all the meta of how to play as a pro, but you didn't trip over and accidentally get carried there and do that. Like, that doesn't exist. So the idea that never existed in CS was kind of whack. Because that's why, actually, I mean, think about the days before we even had FPL guys. You really were just literally, like, it's like, who should we recruit? And the joke is people almost were just, like, looking at tournament, like, fields. Like, is he any good? Oh, I think, did we ever play that guy? It was a joke how you used to recruit. There was no markers. Whereas in this case, like, I doubt it will be considered as viable as the League of Legends one, where it is pretty legit if you get number one. But the key thing, like you're saying, Maui, is it's another way in the game to highlight that you have potential. Because I'll tell you what, whereas before there was a million people who were global elite and we all just assumed, well, if I'm nerdy, you probably got boosted. If you are number one ranked on this ladder and we don't know you, the first question everyone is going to be is, who was that guy? And you're going to immediately get a bit of fame off it. If you're a semi-pro, by the way, people will even start going, oh, maybe he's actually going to be good soon. And I'll give you the last angle, which is, because again, if they do it right, to actually be like top 10 in the world or top 20, you'll have to be actually good. In that scenario, that also shows, like, I would describe that just shows like potential. It doesn't show how good you are at the game. But like in games like League of Legends, I can tell you, when you have a player who gets like number one rank on Europe, like a pretty good region, and then they play pro and they're bad for the first year, it's a way you actually do give them extra leeway. Because what you say is, well, this doesn't make sense, does it? Like in the pro game, he's really struggling, but even when he leaves that game and goes and plays the ladder, he's really good. Like, he actually is beating other players of the same level. What it implies is, like, maybe we hang on to this guy, maybe he has to figure something out about how to play in a team, maybe he gets nervous, but at least it shows essentially like there's more potential to you. Whereas if you don't have this, like, what are we going off? Like you say, FPL games, that's it. Tier 2 or 3 games. I always think, by the way, that's actually even really tricky, because the amount of players I've seen who get picked up because they're a star at tier 3, but then you find out, oh, that was their cap. Like, they are amazing at tier 3, but in tier 2, it's not like they become just an okay, they become a bad player sometimes. I mean, one of the problems is people can't handle that style of game. And lastly, I'll throw this out there just as a sort of bit of food for thought, because people never bring this up in the other games because it's like one of those awkward things that you're not supposed to believe is real. You know, when people claim that, like, it's all harassment and oppression that's keeping certain demographics of people out of the pro scene. Well, spoiler, there's nobody stopping you playing solo queue or matchmaking. You can queue up for that all day long. The algorithm picks who you play with. You can't even get, like, it's not like people could choose, I'm not going to play with you. No, no, the algorithm picks who you play with. So what you do is you make a Smurf account, and if you are one of these demographics, if you're actually that good, you can show us. It's the same in League of Legends. If you were actually that amazing, you could have gone to the top of the NA ladder and showed that, like, you had the skills, you just weren't getting the opportunity. So I also just think, in general, any extra ways for people to show that they are good in at least one dimension of the game, like in this first case, you have to have some raw, basic, fundamental skills to get high on these ladders. Like, I think that's a positive. I think it's a net positive for the community. Like I said, especially for the people where it's like, if you're coming from zero background at all, you'll at least get a little bit of interest. People will pay attention. Who was this person who just come on top? Especially if they don't recognize your name and you're a brand new account. It'll be a way where if you are legit, you can maybe springboard you quicker to the actual pro scene. I'm with you on that. Right. Now let's go to Thorin's good point. Now, what's good is I'd never do a generic point. I always do have an angle for it. So my angle's actually going to be quite a unique one. Spoiler, I am going to be absolutely leaning into the Thorin wheelhouse. We're about to, Alan, wax lyrical about how brilliant Device is. So, you know.
Okay. I'm ready.
Fucking hell, dust off the old tome and go to chapter 700. But there's a way that we're going to do it, though, because actually the thing I want to highlight is this, right? I'm not going to get overhyped. He isn't actually, like, the best opera in the world again, guys. Even when he has an awesome game, I don't do that thing like, he's back, he's... Like, he is really good again. But the point I want to make is this. Mate, it's the way he plays within his game that I think is... I've never seen anyone do this, mate. I've never seen any star player do this. The problem normally with star players is they are so fucking all in. They are so, like, I am the best player. Like, I'm better than my opponent. Like, give me all the resources and I'll carry this game. The thing about Device that is crazy is, unlike... And by the way, this is the other thing. He plays AWPer. I think it's even less likely you get the player like this for an AWPer. If you think of my old mates, Kenny S and Guardian, by the way, goats of the fucking AWPing position, their problem is if they aren't not only the best on their team, but probably the best AWPer in the server, their game already starts to suffer. And if they're ever like in bad form, they have no game, like, because they try to play like they're the best player and it doesn't work. And they can actually, like Guardian did at the end, they can become a liability. They can actually sort of feed in the game. It's not even like they're just doing like, oh, they're only 70% as good. No, they're actually actively the person giving the game away. The way Device plays now, he doesn't play like he thinks he's 2018 prime Device and he's back. He plays so within his game, it is mega, mate. So it means when he has these games where they're getting smashed or he's just not in the game, he's almost never a liability. And then when he has the game where he's feeling it, it's going well, then he does pop off. Then he does get I can't comprehend the efficiency of this player. I think it's actually, like I say, for a star player and someone who does put up numbers, I think it's incredible. This is like a thing I would tell all young stars out there. If you can gain this quality, you can gain like essentially the discipline to know how to play when you're not on your A game. This is how you have a 10-year career, by the way. That's like a star player. The other guys are really going to have to go to tier two or they're going to have to fuck off and play some supportive role. So I don't know if Device will ever be like the best player again at that level. He doesn't need to be though, mate, because he's actually sort of mastered how it seems that I get the sense he has the best sense himself as the game's going on of how the game is. He seems very reflective. And so mad props, because like I say, I've known a lot of great players and almost none of them had this sort of like wherewithal to know like I'm good, but I'm not better. Like most of them, they're all delusional or they're just, fucking the confidence is destroyed. There's no in between for a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, you compare this to, for me, Fallen on Furia right now, and the amount of times I see him in a position where it is all in, and if he misses the shot, he is 100% dead. It's very regular, and it's actually a lot of the thing is like, when I was watching Fallen, especially during this last week of VSO Pro League, he pops off with these crazy multi-frag highlight rounds, but it's because he just puts himself so actively in a chaotic situation. But then watching Device in that same week, it does look more boring. It's not quite as exciting. He did have he actually had a really nice pop-off round against NIP on Inferno, but like there was. He doesn't have to come up with that as much because he's just finding safer shots. He's taking shots that, like you're saying, are more in the flow of the game. He's reading offenses so that he can, on the defense, very frequently just get that singular pick. And like he'll sometimes do something a little bit risky. Like sometimes he'll like actually peek into a Molly because he knows that Molly indicates that they're probably expecting it to cover an angle. So he'll take that extra 30 points of damage. And sometimes it doesn't get him the kill, but at least he creates opportunities for himself that are pretty safe overall and oftentimes actually give him some chances, whereas other people might respect the utility too much. And so, yeah, I think like for Device, I will say his mechanics are still pretty damn good.
Oh, he's still mega. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like he's fallen off completely and that he can be like any. It's almost like with Device, if you did put an AWPer with 80% of his mechanics, though, in some of these positions, they actually would still do very well. And I think that's generally what's so impressive. Whereas Fallen, because his mechanics have fallen off, say that 80%, now you're seeing an AWPer that's putting up these 1.00 ratings in a whole group stage against not even strong opponents. Whereas if this were Fallen of 5 years ago, yeah, he'd have a 1.12 or whatever, because, but he's playing the exact same way as if he's the same player. So Device showing that longevity comes from having really good reads of how to play the game and how to move around it.
By the way, quick disclaimer before Alan jumps in. Alan is one of the rare people, I respect this though, who actually has Device as his GOAT. Just thought that, you know, go then.
Yeah, to explain why, it goes beyond just achievements. It's also having been in and around quite a lot of teams, kind of the ease to play around somebody is a factor for me.
Right.
Or like how much value they bring. If I truly felt someone like Glaive had by virtue of his calling won Astralis all those majors, I would have Glaive as the best player. Device, I just feel like he's such a complete player. He brings so much to the game. Imagine being someone setting up a team around Device. It's almost like he's the perfect middle ground in terms of passive and aggressive and how much space he wants. He's just the AWPer. You don't have to make special concessions. It's not like having a Simple on your team and he does justify a lot of the time, but you have to give him a lot of space. Device finds the middle ground perfectly. He's always been the best player at playing the percentages, how I like to say it is. He always makes the highest percentage decision, and we know from over the years he puts a lot of work in behind the scenes. That's how you build up these fundamentals. It's how you understand the game to a level where you can be in a situation on the fly and say, this is the best way to win this sort of round. And then looking at other AWPers, we know some of them weren't as studious. Kenny S, we know he wasn't, you know, as putting in nearly as much effort outside of the server. And that's almost certainly the number one reason Kenny S has not had the longevity that Device has. Even if Kenny S, he might be a more skilled player. He might have more natural talent at actually using a mouse, but Device is a much more well-rounded person and just brings so much value to the game. So I'm not surprised he's still in great form. I'm not even sure he's dropped off mechanically. I think it just is players of Zywu, Simple, Munizzy, just the sheer like mechanical ability is just, they're just phenoms. That's how good they are in terms of being individuals. So I'm not sure Device has necessarily got any worse. Obviously, maybe just versus the field, he's got a little bit down, but it's just because these players have just innate ability have come up through the rankings that I think he comes off a bit. I think an interesting angle as well with Device is that obviously kind of Shiro and Jame come through as some of the best AWPers in the world over the last couple of years. Maybe not so much for Jame now, but even so, these players almost certainly fully modeled their game off Device.
Yes.
They probably took it a little bit too far. Shiro and Jame, Jame saves more, but they're pretty similar actually in terms of how they like to play passive angles and how they like to sit on lines and really take their time. I think Device is a little bit of a better feel of when to get more aggressive to grab an opportunity than maybe those players do. So yeah, I think Device for every young player should be the model. You break the rules like a Zywu, like a Simple, if you have that sheer mechanical talent where you can bail yourself out a lot of the time. But for the vast majority of players, you need to play like Device. You need to be studious like Device. You need to understand the game to that sort of level. And just making good, consistent decisions, it might not be as exciting to watch. Well, not for the average person. For me, it is. I love it a lot more than just wild Counter-Strike. But that should be the model for all players. Playing the percentages and Device is almost certainly the best ever at doing that.
See, the downside here is I just thought up a great straight fire follow-up point, but it's too good, so I've just written it down for hot take point, mate. Thanks, Alan. Thanks for generating that. Don't worry. You'll hear it on a future show, but I'm not going to burn it here, am I? So what I will just say very briefly is the one thing that I also think is hilarious is this just shows how people's expectations determine if they rave about you or if they're just like, yeah, he's just good. Because, like, you know, now every Zywu fan can't shut the fuck up about how incredible it is that Zywu uses a rifle. You're only about fucking 6 years too late, you moron. Device was doing that when they were winning everything. This is the guy where because they're trying to big up this angle of like, you're only sacrificing. Mate, you think Device couldn't have just told them when they were winning everything, I want to AWP on T-side of info? Of course he could, but he just understood that his coach and IGL are going to have so many more weapons if he can rifle as well. And also that means the rounds that you don't have an AWP, you don't have to save the AWP and you just use a rifle. Like, that's the angle. I can see Alan's angle there. It's also like, it's not just a raw eye test. It's a coaching aspect as well. Like, basically, if you had to take these all-time great players, right, look, you could drop Simple in a team and he'd frag, but the question is, how would he affect his teammates? It does look to me, like, I said this year, 6 years ago about the value. It does look like he is the coach's dream. I'm pretty sure every coach, if they had the choice, like, this is the Harper you build your team around. As long as I'm getting other really great players too. Like, if I have this Harper, I'm fucking safe as houses, mate. I almost can't fail to make my lineup really sick. And I also do get the vibe, if you look at their careers, like, people used to do that thing of, like, chicken and egg. Like, is it Glaive? Is it Device? Like, I'm sorry. I've never thought, like, Glaive was telling Device what to do. Or, like, before the game. He wasn't, like, fucking Blade handing him a dossier. Like, here's what you're going to do. It's quite obvious it was the other way around. That actually all that was off Glaive's plate and Zonic's plate. And Device is just doing it himself because he studied the game and prepped for the opponent. And actually, that is your dream if you're the IGL. That you have a mobile AWP who's going to take his own angles and play however accordingly. And then if you ask him to do something, he might do it. Like, what more do you want? And then he puts up the numbers. Like, it's why it's funny that in the end, like, I've never said this, I'm not one of those guys who do, like, even though I like the coach quotes, I'm not someone who believes that they're, like, from God and they're all, like, facts. They're more just, like, interesting observations. But, like, to me, I would say, if you're a young player, Device is the one who embodies that quote that says, like, you know, essentially, if you don't shortchange the game won't shortchange you. Because this guy played the right way for now, like, we're talking, like, what, like, fucking 10 years or something. At the end, he got all the accomplishments. Like, that's actually what you want every young player to believe. Like, look, you don't actually have to be flashier than simple. If you just play the right way to the max of your ability, we can get you, we actually might be able to get you more accomplishments than simple. We can get you all the trophies and the MVPs. Like, that's sick if you're a young player. That's exactly who you want to look up to. The joke is that if I'm a young AWPer, yeah, obviously your mind's blown by what simple is. I'd have the Device poster on my wall, mate. That's who I want to be. Right. What about yours then, Alan? Because it does actually, Maui almost fucked it by using the fall example. It's okay. We can bring it back. What is your bad point?
Oh, so before I go into mine, I was originally going to just do NA, just blanket of where it is at the moment. But then I thought about it a bit more and I was like, you know, NA, they don't have the depth of the scene. They don't have necessarily all the players. But what scene does? And the answer to that is Brazil.
Okay.
Brazil has incredible players, a depth of talent that's only matched in maybe by no individual country, maybe Russia, but maybe certain European regions that speak the same language if you combine them. But compared to the rest of the world, they have a depth of talent that is insurmountable. They have so many good players. And I kind of can't believe over the last few years, they haven't found a good combination. And I look at this current Furia team, and there are so many good pieces here. Yuri and Cacerato. Yes. As a rifling duo in this current lineup and before, they're literally world-class as a rifling duo. Maybe at times close to being one of the best in the world as a pair of riflers. And they just didn't have the achievements to reflect it, or people weren't recognized compared to some of the others like the Hunter and Ecos of the world. Cello, a phenomenal player in previous teams, probably was at times the best Brazilian player. Maybe couldn't show it again because he's not in the right lineups. And you just have this incredible trio of riflers, and the jury isn't still a little bit not out just yet on Furia, but I don't think this lineup makes a great deal of sense. And then the really funny thing is if you go on like Hatred TV and just look at like rankings of like Brazilian teams, you just see incredibly good players just dotted around. And you're just like, what is going on here? Who has created these lineups? And I guess that's kind of the answer is my outside take on kind of the Brazilian scene is I think the players have way too much say in these lineups. Enormous say in these lineups, probably predicated off the fact that this scene is hinged on social media kind of levels and engagement and this sort of thing. So the players have massive leverage. And these orgs come in and they just see these big things, especially an org like an Imperial. They say, yes, we'll have all these players, these massive followings. And there's nobody in charge. There's nobody saying this lineup doesn't make sense. We need to make a move. They would never have made a Vitality sort of move, a lot of these teams. So that kind of is my overall feeling on the Brazilian scene is somebody needs to come into these teams, the Zeuses, maybe the Peacemakers of the world, and just say, this lineup doesn't make any sense. We need to get the right players in the right places. What is Zevi not doing on one of the top Brazilian teams? Why is someone like Safe didn't work on Furia, but we know he can be good in potentially a different system? Why are we not trying this player out again? Why are there players like Lato and Dumao, who are really great riflers, just dotted around? Why is Art still on Furia when he's not the in-game leader? There's so many questions with this scene, and it's just disappointing because there's so many good players, and it really feels like they're wasting it in a way that no other scene is at the moment.
I think it's due in part to, one, the players having a weird amount of control, but I also think it's part due to the predatory contracts that teams like Furia put into place to try to lock down the players that they have in order to try to find some sort of return for the salaries that they knew they were going to have to pay. Because back in 2019, every single player that was on Furia, and we're talking Caserato, Art, and Yuri, but then we're also talking Vinny and Abel J, were extended by 5 years, which still hasn't even ended. Technically, Abel J is a streamer for Furia to this day, because and he's kind of in a way in contract jail. Like, there's no one that's, I mean, people weren't really looking at Abel J as like, who could, where should he go next necessarily, because it was obvious that as a support player, Vinny was a better fit and a better overall pit player. But like, to see that he can't even really play professionally because no one's going to want to get him out of that contract, that to me is more the problem with Brazilian CS, where I remember also the buyouts were just some extraordinarily high numbers, where when it was like things that were just unbelievable, actually. I feel like, Thorin, you would probably remember better than I what some of those numbers would be for some of the Brazilian players, but it was almost there was some like name of like a pro soccer player that basically was like, you can't make the contract too crazy because of this rule we had back in Brazilian football. But it's like there's so many weird contracts with what's going on there. So I would say it's there's probably some hand. I mean, the players have something to do with the fact that the structure of these teams is pretty whack, but I also think like teams like Furia are they definitely shoulder the blame too, because 5 year contracts in esports just seems absurd.
Yeah, I've got a few angles on this one. It's a good topic because, first of all, I actually think people will be a bit surprised by that, Alan, because as you notice, you've already sort of started to answer the question when you name the names. Because notice, none of those are big names that you've just listed off. Even people like Safe, because their big shot was actually on Furia, people don't know this is a good player. Like, people didn't watch him play on Pain Gaming. They actually think he's just like a whatever, but who cares? Like, the joke is, I'm shocked that the second he left this team, he didn't just immediately have like a really good lineup made around him and he's the star AWP. Like, that would be the obvious move to me. But you notice that this is why it answers its own question. All the players who are good aren't the big names. They're not the ones that we all know. And at the moment, I agree with you. I actually think you can go one further. It's not just that players control the scene too much. Mate, it's that motherfucking SK team controls the scene too much. They are treated like gods. And then now what they do is they just mess up all the other lineups, partly by inserting themselves, but then also recruiting each other even. Like, it's actually gross. Like, the stupid thing is, if you look at like Fallen, ColdZera, Taco, like these guys just spread out across the scene. And then like, of those players, like Fur individually was playing well, Tackle was all right. The rest, like ColdZera and Fallen, like me, these guys are so far from what they seem to think their own level is, at least publicly, that like I think they do bring these teams down. And so I get the vibe that like the old great players are almost like vampirically just like sucking the fucking potential out of these young players and wasting it because of the lineups they're making. And also another problem is Furia is now doing what really tilts me, which is not only do you shit the bed, but then you just hoard all the talent in one team. Like, mate, if I can split these players up, I can make a bunch of good lineups elsewhere. But we're going to take the far and away the best player, Caserato, and just lock him in prison, doing 1.25 fucking games that he loses. And then we're going to take people who, like we're saying, the other players, like some of them, like the joke is even Art would probably be better in a different team. Find a team that fits his style and maybe it could work. I even think Art, quite frankly, is the new Fallen. He just has some bizarre, like, they all worship him. No one, none of them seem to want to cut him. They all still think he's like a great IGL as well. And his individual game's fallen off. Not as much as Fallen's, but it's nowhere near what it used to be in like 2019, 2020, when he was a super dynamic player with a very unique style and could cause all this mayhem. Now he's not only figured out, but like his game isn't as good. And as an IGL, he died about 2 years ago. Like, that's just been whack for a long time. So then you look at the names that they have out there. And the problem is, these are all not famous people. They are people in teams like Pain Gaming, 00 Nation, obviously the old lineup, fucking Imperial when they had, the joke is, it was everyone except Fallen was interesting, like the cello guy actually had real potential, MIBR even though their lineups on paper look shit. I can tell you, if you ever watch the tournaments that MIBR plays, they nearly always have like at least one good player in the lineup. There's always one where you're like, actually, he's not bad. What the fuck's he doing in this team? But that's the problem. Essentially, the best talent goes to Furia, then underperforms. And everyone else is just spread out and they never connect. Because if you look at some of the names, Alan, like Zevi's one, like you said, obviously from Fluxor. But dude, there's two of them on Pain. Skulls, yeah. If people don't know, I don't know how this player never gets in the mix. Did he just like fuck someone on Fury's dog or something? What's going on? Like, why this guy is one of the most obvious pickups ever as a rifler. And then fucking Big Azera, he even seems pretty good as well. Like, these two, whenever I watch Payne, I'm like, why aren't they immediately in a better team? Like, some of the others, yeah, I'm with you also on the 0-0 Nation guys. The joke is, it was everyone except fucking Caldera and Taka who's interested in that lineup. But everyone's only watching them for the legendary name. Then the underperformers of the team and everyone goes, I guess there just isn't the talent in Brazil. It's like, there is. We're just misusing it. We're just fucking wasting everyone's time. So I think it could be way, way better, mate. I'm with you. Not only could Fury themselves, if they got it together, actually be like a real elite team in the world, you could have a really strong second team. This could be like the days when you had SK and Immortals, and the Immortals was like the dark horse upset team. You could have two squads like that. Instead, what you've got is like four squads. One of them's like all right but bad for tier one Furia, and then the rest are just good tier two teams that never make the use of their talent. Like, me and Alan have watched a bunch of these games. I'm telling you, if you've never seen this player Skulls, he's not on a famous team, he's way better than you think. Tell you right now, you'll be actually shocked that he's actually pretty legit. Like, the eye test checks out immediately, mate.
Yeah, and he's a role player, crucially, which is Brazilians known for aggressive riflers, and that isn't Skulls. Like, probably replace Art with him, swap a different rifler into Art's spots, and you've probably instantly got a better team. That just makes more sense and easier to call around. It's just so frustrating. Dumal as well. Dumal's another guy that he was so good on that double elimination and the Godsend team. And he should be on a better lineup. You just keep going down, and it's just a real shame. And I reckon beyond just a few couple good teams, you could probably build four top 30 teams, I'd say, from these players. And in other scenes where you have such an obvious hierarchy between the teams, it just doesn't look right, does it? If you look at the Danish rankings, yes, Astralis and Heroic might have some players on either side that could swap over, but there's nothing obvious in the Brazil. It's just a complete mess, and there really is no hierarchy after Fury. It's just a complete free-for-all, predicated again on, as Maui said, maybe contracts having a big factor too, where you just can't move people around because it's just completely out of control.
Yeah. Right, come on then, Maui. What is your bad point?
Mine is Gamer Legion and where they are right now. And the reason I bring this up is because a lot of people looked at this Gamer Legion team after they lost Shuhei and after they lost Ima and thought, okay, well, there's probably no reason to really pay attention to this team anymore. And I'm kind of fighting two things right now. The way that, I've actually found them overrated, and I kind of can't believe I'm saying that given the people that are on their team.
It's because they've had some upsets on paper, you know, so like, I think people are overhyping them for sure.
Yeah, it's really strange to me how people talk about this roster, because it does feel like some people are, in a way, pleasantly surprised, but in terms of what they've actually done since losing those players, sure, they beat the Mongols, they beat Fnatic, they beat Apex, Greyhound, and NIP. Like, that's not, to me, that's not impressive. And a lot of people, like, where I say this, first of all, is community perception around Nilan, where people are like, oh, Nilan's a great IGL, and, you know, nobody could have made that EG team work. And I watched this team play, and I would say that Nilan's T-sides sometimes overcomplicate mid-rounds, where he actually tries to do too many things at once. And I've seen, like, I've been talking about on, for example, the last hot take point made, the way that G2 has made Inferno look so simple, where they just take banana control and execute. It feels like, well, it doesn't feel like it. What Nilan does so often is they'll actually get control of a space, and then they'll, like, try to retake map control other places, and in the commotion of trying to do multiple things in the same round, they end up losing players and sometimes actually attacking the bomb site that had more people on it. And that's one of those things where it's always tough when we have X-Ray and he doesn't to know, like, why did he make these calls? But the main thing about Gamer Legion and the bigger point here is the fact that they're still ranked 7th on HLTV and the ESL World Rankings when they are as mediocre as they are. I would personally probably put this Gamer Legion team is 14th or 15th best in the world. And the fact that they still somehow have this 7th ranking on both of the rankings that do matter means that they get invites to tournaments like IEM Sydney. And the thing is, now when we see this team at IEM Sydney, they couldn't even get out of an ESL Pro League group that has a Furia team that is barely holding on for dear life. Like, this Gamer Legion team is by no means capable of doing any damage when they get to IEM Sydney. And for one of the tournaments that's going to be probably one of the last S tier events of the year, I think it's pretty much Sydney, there's going to be this Chinese tournament, there's going to be the Fall Finals and World Finals. I think those are probably the last four S tier tournaments, to the best of my knowledge. And to even waste a slot on a team that they don't even really have like a serious fan base. Like, I almost feel like, in a funny way, there's an argument to put a team like Greyhound there, because it's like, okay, at least it's the home team and you can actually justify that because maybe people will buy their tickets. Like, there's a financial incentive for ESL to even do that. But I can't even give you a real reason why the ESL hasn't adjusted their ranking to take Gamer Legion down a peg or two. Like, I'm actually legitimately confused how they didn't lose more ranking points when they made the swap to pick up Volt and Neelan. But I think it has to be because Volt had some points when he came from Into the Breach for doing well with that roster. And then I actually don't know how Neelan took any points with him onto this roster, if any. So for me to just see them at these events and to getting invites because they're still a top 10 team on HLTV, to me just seems criminal, because this team is by no means a top 10 team. Like, there's no world in hell.
No, it's, I mean, you put them a 14th, they might even be in kind of real terms lower. The fun thought experiment with Gamer Legion to play is look at the lineup and then imagine we're just before Paris or even before the RMRs, and look at the lineup and say, what is this? You know, what is this team? Who are the star players here? Where are we expecting this team to place against other top teams? And nobody in their right minds would say they could be a top 25 team or a top 20 team. It just doesn't have the makeup of a lineup like that. And yeah, I mean, as you bring up, it certainly highlights some problems in the ranking system, and it certainly needs to take a bigger tanking off the back of losing players. And something we do a lot as people that follow the scene is we like to distinguish different lineups, especially if it's just one player change and they're similar players. Yes, there's some continuity, but the bigger the changes and taking in the context, the more you separate these things. And certainly when you're losing your best player and your in-game leader, this isn't the same team that played in Paris remotely. So many things would have changed, so many positions, so many different aspects of the game. How their win conditions for games are completely different. So the idea that they're still seventh is wild. I'm a little bit confused how that kind of is even possible. Maybe it's just by virtue of some of the other top teams not playing loads or something. But yeah, for sure, Game Legion isn't a top 10 team. They're not going to remain in the top 10. And I mean, on the Neelan angle, I feel like everybody that's super up on Neelan didn't watch K23 or didn't really know a lot about that team, because we as Endpoint used to scrim them a lot because they were around that kind of top 25 to top 40 level. The idea that the in-game leader of that team would be a strategic mastermind is crazy to me, because that team was wild. They just played off the individuals. They just ran in all the time. Not to say Neelan hasn't developed, but to paint his CV like it's really in depth and he's definitely a really well-rounded in-game leader is crazy. And so it reflects people that haven't actually watched his career a great deal. So I'm not saying Neelan can't be a really great in-game leader, but he isn't today. And the reason maybe EG did have a bit of a spike when he came in is just because they had a system, not necessarily because it was a great system or he's a great in-game leader, just because they had a system. There was a philosophy shared between those players. So the reason I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, let's just be clear here, we're kind of more criticizing the rankings rather than Gamer Legion or the fan base as well, because with Gamer Legion, their resources and the players they could get, I'm not sure they could make a lineup that much better than this. That's the fundamental truth. But yeah, they're not going to stay seventh, and the team realistically shouldn't be aiming for that anyway. So yeah, it's all a bit wacky. I'm not sure how they're here, and they're not going to be here for that much longer, unfortunately.
To pick up on what you said at the end there, I will also agree. I actually do think this is about the best you could GM the squad. Remember, I know people are going to think, but they were in the major final. Like, that will be the only thing that is ever mentioned as a piece of trivia about the team Gamer Legion. They are like, it really was just like some little fucking kids Disney movie. We're like, oh my God, a no-name team's all the way in the final. Like, yeah, that's it though. And it's never going to happen again. And they've changed the team so fundamentally. Like you say, it's not the same squad at all. Like, you've literally taken the two most important pieces completely off the team and replaced them with inferior players. Like, first of all, the Nealon guy, remember, Shuey could even frag me. He was doing a good job as an IGL, and he was fragging. And I'll throw this in there as well. I think he had a knock-on effect, because I keep making this point on shows, but a lot of people aren't putting the connecting the dots. That interview Torji did when he knew Shuhi was coming back to Mouse, where he low-key flamed Dexter for not microing him as the AWPer, my first thought was, well, that explains the magical Acor fucking resurgence, doesn't it? If the IGL, if Shuhi's style is to be like quite controlling over his AWPer and tell him when he wants him to peak and when to do a play and so, like, now suddenly it makes sense why Acor was having like little run of form again. Now that he's gone, that's gone again. Like, Acor is just an average AWPer at tier one. I've seen him play the Lords now. He'll hit flaky, nice shots, but he just isn't a guy who's going to produce a lot. And he clearly, mentality wise, isn't one of those guys with like a killer instinct. He's just a guy who just plays the game, and if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So already, you don't have much firepower. Like, I think the firepower in this team is atrocious relative to a team that, like you're saying, is ranked number 7 in the world. Because that's why, to go back to what Maui said at the beginning, when people are seeing these like upsets or like close games, you're doing that thing where you're going, right, so if they do that and then they can improve some, no, that's it. Like, that's the plateau for me. I even think that's the height. And as you say, once you actually get into the weeds of analysing who they're playing, it just isn't even that good anymore. Like, first of all, they had the two big games where they won a map off Heroic and Cloud9, right? One, Heroic is in probably the worst form this lineup has ever been in, far and away. Like, they're in really bad form right now. Two, so, like, in that match, for example, the next round is where they got utterly shit on by Ents. Like, that's who you're taking the press. So, like, Heroic won the event, guys. And then the Cloud9 one is Fugazi as fuck. That was when they didn't have fucking Axile. That was the one where they had to use Buster. And they still beat you in three maps. Mate, I think that's a point to them, not you. You don't get a point for that. They were right there for the taking. That should have been you in the bloody playoffs of Cologne. Then I'd be able to give you some props. But the real problem, as we come back, is look at the lineup, and there's no way this team can make it. Nealon is just an average IGL. And quite frankly, I hate even that angle of like, yeah, but he's so creative though. Mate, the joke there would be, when you're in a team like EG and you just never win, you got to do something to justify your job. Yeah, I'd be in the bloody lab all day long. I'd be doing all sorts of crazy smoker. Because you're not going to win the fucking round. The only way you can actually look competent is to have some weird... It's like that thing last year where everyone... This is real. This isn't even a meme. This really was the narrative back behind the scenes with pro players. Was like, wow, don't fucking Fury have all these creative smokes. And I always used to tell people, it'd be nice if they won some fucking games with it then, wouldn't it? What are we talking about here? Like, the joke again is like that... That's like part one of a cool compliment. Like, you have great smokes and it's making your team really... No, it's not like you have great smokes. You still lose every bloody game. Like, what? What's the props? Like, the point of Counter-Strike is to win rounds and to be dangerous in the server. It's not to like... It's not synchronized swimming. You're not just doing some crazy trick or showing something off. Like, at the end of the day, that's probably the most overrated thing in all of esports is innovation. Like, I give a fuck less about innovation. I care about what works. I don't care about how creative it is. Like, you can do the most boring... Like Maui said, you can just have Nico go up fucking banana every round and hold the corner with his godlike game and win every time. It won't be at all innovative, but I tell you what, you'll win a fucking lot of rounds doing that, and it's really hard to stop. So on the Nealon one, that is so overblown, because basically people are trying to find a bright spot in the dung heap that was EG. And, like, that was one of the bright spots, but it was just such a bad team. Like, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant at this level. At the top 10 ranked level, Nealon is an irrelevant player. And then you look down the rest of the lineup, mate, where are the bright spots? The Isaac guy is all right, and quite frankly, that game against Heroic has made people think he's about four times better than he is, because he had those crazy rounds. That isn't happening game to game. I've watched him play. He isn't in the... Like, I never watched this team like, wow, you need Emma and Isaac on a top team. It's like, he's okay. He's just okay. And I'll just say it right now. I think the Chaos guy is just a fundamentally bad player, mate. I've seen him. He's been playing for years. People are acting like he just came out now of like FPL. He's just been playing for years. He's just a whatever player. There's nothing about this player that excites me. So if I look at the squad overall, where's the firepower? Where are the star players? Like, here's what you need to do to know this isn't even a team that has huge dark horse potential. Think to yourself, in 6 months from now, which player are they coming to, Imer and Shuhei style, to quickly snatch from this team? Nobody. There's no one on this lineup. Everyone's like headhunting. We'll keep an eye on him. There's no like fucking Anakin Skywalker. Well, we'll keep track of your career, young Skywalker. Like, no one's doing that. Like, this is whack. So to me, they, like, what they've done now, props, enjoy it. What you did was, after a massive roster mania, you got a couple of upsets. Oh yeah, I didn't even complete the one. I did like the teams they almost beat. The teams they did beat are in the most dire straits imaginable, right? No one believes in that new Fnatic squad, I'll tell you that right now. No one even mentions them anymore on these bloody shows. We just forget they exist. Then you have like the Mongols, spoiler, they keep changing bloody players. They're clearly not happy with their team right now as it is. And then, who was the other one? Oh, NIP. Holy shit, if NIP's your scalp, mate. NIP looks like the most meh team of all time. Like, they just look like they're going to be permanently sat at, like, number 12 in the world for the next 8 months and just every now and then go, like, top six once, ninth to 12th next. Like, they're not going to do anything. Like, bro, actually tell me when you do something. You know what I mean? Like, who am I supposed to be bragging about in these results? Like, it's not like you came and, you know, here's the thing. If you'd won a map off like Ents and then you'd gone against like fucking G2 and you'd almost had like an upset, then I'm getting excited. This team is just whatever. Like we say, it's a mixture of hold over in the rankings from what the major lineup did, brand new rosters, meaning other people probably change where they're at. And then I would say finally, just some like odd fluky maps, just a map here and there that just went well. Like, I don't get it, because to me, eye test is really meaningful. And I don't think there's any eye test value here to this team. Like, I don't get it myself. Like, even though they haven't had great results themselves, I have way more interest in that Apex lineup than I do in this fucking lineup, mate. The Apex lineup has some good players. Like, maybe they can get it together. This one, I don't think it can do anything. I'm not even hating. I just think it's, like you say, if you just make it about expectations of where they're ranked, they just make it inappropriate that they ranked so high. There's no way they can live up to that ranking ever. Come on.
Yeah, the main point is the ranking. And that's why, like, in these discussions about who's rated what, what's overrated, what's underrated, like, the thing is, and I'll take a little shot right here. You know, like, the thing is that if you go on, like, an HLTV confirmed or something like that, you're going to probably, they'll probably be like, oh, like, this Gamer Legion team, not exciting. But they would probably never say it's overrated. And yet the main thing, the reason is, like, I'm looking at your ranking that you help build, and they are clearly overrated. Like, so the main point about what's bad about Gamer Legion is the fact they are simply overrated by every ranking system. And, like, I'm not even coming at any of the players, really. I just think, like, people are always so forgiving when people are quiet. And that's one thing that Gamer Legion have done very well for themselves instead of in terms of PR. Nobody on this team has gotten loud about, oh, they actually think that they're better than they really are.
Yes.
Like, the only hyping that they've done for themselves was Kiaz when he was screaming at every match during the major because he was trying to be a hype guy. But, like, so this team is going to kind of quietly just slowly slip down the rankings.
And the obvious joke there, Maui, is, to be fair, that's the one time ever his entire life on this planet Earth he'll ever be able to do that. So fair play. Go for it, mate. Get it out of your system now. You'll never be there again. So you'll never be on that major stage again. So you get out of your system now. I don't blame you. You know, it's whatever. It was, for you, it was like fucking, it's like a Make-A-Wish Foundation scenario. So, you know, enjoy the rest of your life.
Yeah,
I'm not sure at the end of Make-A-Wish Foundation they do say enjoy the rest of your life and then leave you, but whatever. You get the point. Come on.
This is why when that major happened, the Paris major happened, where people are like, respect the underdog story, and then we knew as people who have just been watching the scene for long enough, like, this team's just gonna get picked apart. Like, this team is like, there's two people that are incredibly valuable for this roster, and once they're gone, which they will be, there's going to be nothing left of this team that's worth watching at all. And I don't know, in some way, it's like people are still being too nice to them, but, like, it's just not even entertaining Counter-Strike at the end of the day to watch these guys play. So, yeah.
This can tie into my next point, though, because I actually think if you look at the problems with Gamer Legion, it's going to actually be a good segue into my bad point, which is this new TSM lineup that they've made is a great example of how not to GM teams, much like Gamer Legion squad, and the reasons why are very similar. This is a mistake I will say I had to learn myself. It took me many years. I've made a million of those videos where I do a brand new lineup and I hypothetically figure out, you know, how would these roles work? And I'll tell you the number one mistake you can make, and it goes like this. To say, anyone who's played fantasy football will know what I'm talking about too. You start making a lineup and you're going like, yeah, he's not bad. You're not bad. Okay, we'll keep him. Ooh, yeah, he's pretty good actually. And at the end, you go, I never got a big star player, but it's okay. I've got a good lineup though. It's like, no. That's actually the opposite of how teams work. With a big team, you got to have your main players first. Then you can add in, you know, a questionable player, a player with potential, a player who's not bad. He's a bit better than people think. But if you don't have those stars, the worst team you can build is a team like this TSM squad, where it's like you've got a bunch of role players that are good, interesting, they can add something, maybe they're better. But at the end of the day, you don't have the top 20 players. You don't have those players that are going to win you the game and produce the numbers. And so if you look at the TSM lineup, the first glance, you're going to go, this isn't a bad lineup. Hey, I actually like some of these players. You know what? Maybe this... But then you forget that, like, essentially, if we were being brutal, the TSM lineup essentially is going to rely on the Mordor guy from Romania, who's barely ever played any lands, by the way. He just needs to be like Monacy. And if he isn't, it's over already. Because the point is, some are like Inters. They're like floor raisers. I actually think that Jack Stevens not a bad player. But these are players who are very low, like frag-wise production. Like, they already almost demand you have a Monacy to make up for that. So then if you've got like a questionable, like, we're just going to throw this guy in there, it's not going to work. Like, I actually think, unfortunately, like I said, I'm willing to take the hit myself. I've had a lot. I mean, I'll give you an example if people want a historical example. A few years back, if you remember, they did that reboot of like Dignitas, where it was like Jacob and Fox. And it was like, again, the same thing. It's like a bunch of players, like, hey, they're not bad, but they never had actual real firepower. And I had to realize when I watched them play, like, bro, essentially they'd need like the perfect game. So same scenario here with TSM. They would need like the perfect game from Jax and Cypher. And because there's the other one, people are going to look at this lineup and see Cypher's name and go, well, there it is. There's the stats. Like, that's not even his game. Cypher's whole job, if you're a fan of stats, is to break that HLTV impact meter. That's his rating, because he's a guy who's going to do loads of aggressive entry. He's always going to die a load. That's even his game. Like, the joke is he is the guy, like he had in this series, I saw everyone on Twitter. He's the guy who can have the series where he gets the most kills, but also the most deaths. That's who he is as a player. Like, that player isn't going to give you a plus 30 series consistently. So if that's your star, you're fucked already. He needs to be like your third best player. Then you're cooking with gas, mate. Now we can talk. So like I said, the Game Legion one's bad enough because they're highly ranked, but dude, a lot of people actually seem hyped about it. I know it's because TSM's the org, but people seem hyped about this lineup. I don't know what there is to be hyped about. I even individually, like I say, like a bunch of the players. I just don't know what, like, at the end of the day in Counter-Strike, I say this about sports. Basketball, at the end of the day, is about putting the ball through the hole. You can have all the best defenders and pass. If you can't put the ball in the hole enough, you won't win. It's the same in Counter-Strike. I know we like to wax about the fucking team play and tactics and how you do. At the end of the day, you have to be able to shoot people. If you don't have one or two players who are really good at just killing people, you cannot win in Counter-Strike. It's just not possible.
Yeah, I think the first way to look at this TSM lineup is which players are a sure thing and which have a big question mark next to them. And you go down the lineup: Valde, Calling.
Brand new IGL as well. That's another thing. People are activating to Oldfelder. It's brand new IGL, yeah. Guys. He's totally switched his role.
Yeah, he's a totally different role. I mean, I know he has dabbled in it in the past. He does have the personality, actually, to be quite a good
game
leader.
But
still, for him to hit the ground running would be surprising. Not an expectation, for sure. Modo, inexperienced, definitely is going to have a lot of transitioning problems, assuming they even get to a level where he's playing where it's a problem, which actually isn't for sure. Jax is probably the most sure player on this lineup. Again, he's a player that didn't play on those G2 teams because he wasn't necessarily the best at English. He might have improved since then. I assume he has a little bit, but again, that's another question mark. Cypher, in terms of playing top-level play, pretty inexperienced.
Yep.
I know he's quite a green player, for sure. He would be a good player that's just like a spearhead against with other good players rounding out the lineup, but that isn't this team. And then Inters is playing English. And you just go through the lineup, and the number of things that have to go right for this to be competitive, let alone good, is
absurd. Oh, mate, I hadn't even thought that angle, actually, Alan. That's even worse. Like, if anything, you might not even get the Inters we saw because he's going to have to communicate in English the whole time. Yeah. Like, that actually might impact his game. I hadn't even thought that angle, yeah.
It's the same for all of them. You don't even if you, as a lot of people do, you come in and you look at the players they were recently, or maybe, you know, you take a slightly positive approach, say they were really good at this. That is... The chances of them reproducing that in this team are really low. I think Jax will actually be pretty good. But outside of that, I wouldn't have high expectations for this team. And the reason we're going to dig into them quite a lot is I have to assume that TSM does salary pretty good. They would surely have had other options for players in different ways they could go. And for me, this is a really bad route to take if you're a team like them. And I think the one angle you can give a lot of orgs and new teams coming into CS is an angle at the moment is they're probably looking towards growing into Counter-Strike 2, like Liquid, as we might talk about later on, and having players that maybe not the whole lineup's going to make it, but at least there's going to be a core of players here that's going to exist through to that first CS2 major, and you make progressive train changes and you iterate. That is the problem with this TSM team is I don't even know what you can salvage from this. You might have to make massive changes. What if Valde doesn't work as an in-game leader? You're right back at square zero. Who knows how you're going to take this team? So I really think this is a bad way to go. And, you know, to put other examples on the table, you could probably have had Bad News Eagles. Maybe they're not going to get into a top 10 sort of position, which is where I guess TSM wants to end up in the end. But they're going to be better than this team. I think the real team that everybody's not really thinking about is actually 9, the Polish team. And the reason I really think they're a good lineup is I think they play good Counter-Strike for the first part. But also, if you're looking long-term, the depth of talent in Poland is enormous. You're going to have player options. So if you could get 9 out of their contracts, which maybe they're in contract hell, but I have to assume that TSM has the spending power to get a 9 team out of their contracts. That's the way I would have gone, yes, is to get a lineup like that or take the core of that players and then get somebody from the Polish team that really knows it and say, what are 2 other players we could get in to round this out? To go the way TSM has, and also XTAZ wasn't even, had that weird shenanigans where he wasn't even like sure if he was on the lineup a lot as the coach. And it's just, there's just way too many questions. And I don't know why an org of TSM scale has put their name against this team, because it's not going to be a good look in 6 months. I think that is almost certain.
Put it this way. Here's what you do as a thought experiment. Imagine the same lineup, but I just take the Mordor guy and that's Dexter instead. Mate, immediately, now we've got an interesting lineup. But like, as you say, Alan, there's too many question marks. Almost, in fact, once I now know the Inter's angle, it is only Jax is the one I can sort of rely on to play the game. What do you think, Maui? Where are you at on this one? Because I was actually almost shocked. I know part of it probably is because it's the org TSM and people think they've got money and stuff. Dude, the actual general community response is fairly positive to this team. Have you noticed that? People are kind of like hyped about it. I don't know if it's the Extaz angle or what, but fucking, I don't get it though, because I look at the lineup, I'm like, what is this?
Extaz was the one thing that had me feel like, okay, maybe this team can perform above the sum of its parts. When I look at this team, actually, it's not that there's too many questions for me. It's actually that there's too many certainties. It's actually the fact that I know what Jax is as a player. I know what Inter's ceiling is as a player. I even know what Valde has been providing as an individual. And in terms of these question marks that you guys are bringing up, it's almost like, how bad could they be? Like, the questions for me are almost like, how in a negative direction can it go worse than what Jax was doing with Vitality when he was standing in for them last season of Pro League? Can Inter's be worse because of what Alan said, in that he's now speaking English for the first time on a competitive lineup? Is Moto even going to be decent against tier one opposition as an opper? Like, there's, and Cypher, it's like we were, for in a lot of ways, the rating of Cypher is, and the, it's like the eye test and rating of Cypher are both weirdly good, but then I look at a stat that I usually care about a lot, like KD, and it's so bad, and I'm, yep, like, it's not supposed to be a star player's scoreline like that. And so for me with TSM, I think the thing is that when I look at rosters that I think are well composed and have room to grow, what I usually see from those is a veteran IGL who has proven himself that he can lead teams to, say, playoffs at tier one events, and one other savvy veteran who can help be a glue guy. And I think of a great example of this in history was that MAU Sports lineup in 2019. I thought that team was very well composed, where you had Woxic, who was a wild card, you had Rops, who was on the come up, you had Frozen, who was on the come up, and then you had Kerrigan and Chris J as these glue guys who are going to make sure that this team is going in the right direction all the time, and they're going to fill in the gaps in terms of macro elements. It's like, oh, we need a guy who's going to do this to take space so that we can unlock our stars. And I look at this team, and I don't really know who they're making space for. Like, who on this team do I want to get all the resources to actually win games? What are the win conditions of this team other than just playing across the board decent CS? Like, there needs to be some sort of edge that makes this team to me stick out. And right now they do not have that by any means. If Cypher performs even as well as he did during the major, I don't necessarily think that is going to always lead to winning Counter-Strike. strike against top eight teams. I don't think that if Moto even performs to the numbers that he has so far, I don't think that's necessarily going to produce winning Counter-Strike against top eight teams. And then the other three players in Jax, Valde, and Inters, I know what they're going to do. And those can be contributing members to good teams, but I don't necessarily think that that's going to take them above and beyond to even punch their way into the top 15. I'll say my prediction with this TSM lineup. I would be shocked if they break into the top 18 on HLTV rankings. I would be so shocked because they are not a partner team with ESL. They are not a partner team with Blast. I don't know what qualifiers they expect to be getting through because the European talent and the teams that are in that tier 1.52 scene, that's brutal. Like, yep. Getting past teams like BetBoom consistently, who to me have already proven themselves more so in qualifiers, and team like Nines that are vying for those spots, I don't think that they have a chance without making at least two roster changes to break into the top 15.
Oh, by the way, I've realized I'm actually even being too silly using the hypothetical of Dexter. The worst part about this lineup, Alan, is if everyone remembers the hype of a few months ago when we heard the rumor, the original one of the players with Jax was bloody Sirison. Like, that's actually an interesting lineup, mate, if they could have had him. The joke is of all the players listed. Remember, it was like Dupree, Sirison, Jax. It's like, and Jax is the only one we got out of those. Like, at least if I have Dupree, I have the angle, maybe he could become a star again. Sirison, by the way, already is a good player. He just wasn't like world class all the time. Like, the sad thing is, that's why I say I don't think it's like terrible roster construction, but I think you sort of, it's ass backwards, you know what I mean? It's like you've put in the role players and then you forgot to actually add any stars.
I assume you end up with this lineup because you come in with grand ambitions. You get X-Taz on board, you get Lambert in as assistant coach, you get certain elements of the team in, and then you don't get certain contracts over the line for certain players, and you end up compromising it's a bit like Cloud9 actually, the Flashpoint team. And you just keep compromising on players until you end up with a lineup so far from your initial ambition, when you might have, let's be real, you might have already negotiated contracts with some of these players, or maybe they haven't signed, but you're probably in the ballpark for salary and length and stuff for some of these guys. I think, as Maui said, top 18. I wouldn't be surprised if this team doesn't crack top 30 playing in Europe. It's a death sentence. There's so many good teams. Maybe long-term some of these players can be good, but if this lineup can work, X-Taz and Lambert as a coaching core need to do some serious, amazing stuff with Modo and Cypher, because that for me is the only real potential in this team, is getting more out of those players than we necessarily expect at the moment.
By the way, when I have a look, this actually also does make me question, either was it the case that, like, because I think nearly all these players were buyouts, except maybe the Mordor guy, I guess, because a lot of them would involve buyouts. Like, TSM has money, but I can tell you they don't have, like, loads. Like, in League, for example, they're downsizing the operations and stuff. So the real question I have is, I think you're probably right, Alan. I think what happens is when they were making their board of, like, we've got this guy, now we talk to this guy, I think eventually you don't have enough money. Because if I look, as well as Sirison, another name was Zorta, was apparently on the board that people thought he could get. The problem with these players is they're all buyouts. So, like, I don't know if it's they didn't want to join, they couldn't do it. But, like I say, you've just missed on the players you needed. Like, if you have any of these players, by the way, Dexter, Zorta, Sirison, now I start to get interested. Now you're perking, hey, maybe there's something here. Because the other thing I want to do with this team, but I can't, is I want to look at the Valde angle, like you say, Alan, and go, hey, I actually think he could be a good IGL one day. Maybe he will get good here. But one, he's brand new to the role. So, at a minimum, I'm going to expect the first 6 months is something of a write-off. He's sort of teething himself. And then secondly, this is some Alexi B shit. What's he working with? It wouldn't matter if he was a good IGL. Like, you'd have to actually be like the greatest IGL of all time to win with this team. Like, it's not going to happen. So just a bit of a whatever for me. I'm just shocked. Again, like I say, it's more I'm just shocked how many people had a positive reaction. I thought everyone would be cynical as fuck and just look at this like, what is this? Okay then, Alan,
I'll say one thing, Thorin, about that. Why the community's perception was like that. I feel like people just really like some of the individuals. People were like I remember Launders' tweet was like, any team with Jax, I'll watch. And it's like, I get you're a fan of him, but like, are we really... I don't know if I'm even going to believe that. Like, are you really going to watch this team through tier two tournaments, like, as qualifiers coming?
Here's the real problem with that. He really just means, I like Jax. Because when he says that, that's like, you know, it's a classic saying if people don't know from the NBA. One of the ways you give a compliment is you say, that's one of those players I'd pay to watch play. No one's ever said that about Jax, motherfucker. No one ever goes, you know what? My list goes Simple, Ziwu, Nico, Jax. Like, get the fuck out. Which name doesn't belong on this list? You know what I mean? Like, give me a break, bro. Give me a break.
And then I saw similar things about, like, oh, yeah, Inter's got back on a team. And then, oh, yeah, Valde. We like Valde, right? We all like Valde. Yeah. Everybody looks around like, everybody like still likes Valde, right? Yeah. Like, not just me anymore.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Oh. Right, okay, then. Alan, what is your ugly point?
Oh, so my ugly point is kind of Team Liquid. And this is actually quite a good contrast with TSM, because the reason I chose this is ugly and not bad, because I'm not sure this Liquid team is doomed. I'm not sure it can never be good. I'm not sure there's not a good basis here. But this is just ugly to watch at the moment. Just the composition of players and the way they've taken this lineup and what is frankly a big risk for them in terms of now being EU-centered as a team and having to play through those qualifiers and the RMRs. That shit is crazy. As compared to the Americas qualifier, the risk of not making majors, missing out on that sticker money is enormous. And maybe not having a major in the second half of the year was a factor. But when I look at this Liquid team, there are a lot of good pieces here. I think, you know, Patsy was an excellent player on Spirit. He was aggressive. He was proactive. He was, for me, the next Yekindar. He was so similar to Yekindar as a player. He almost certainly modeled a lot of his game off Yekindar. And first of all, that's why it's bizarre to me that they're on the same team. Is because they're such similar players. They played almost exclusively the same spots and roles. Yes, Yekindar is calling, which is going to move him around a little bit, but there is absolutely going to be a role clash between these players. And someone has to cede. It kind of feels like it's more so Yekindar, at least on the T side at the moment, as he's falling back to Coolmore. But that is not going to be a clean transition. That is for sure. Rainwaker comes in out of nowhere. He's a good player. Did I expect him on this lineup? No. Could he be good in a year? Maybe. But again, it's a little bit bizarre. And then the whole Yekindar kind of calling sort of angle is... My take on Yekindar is... I like Maui at times have been caught up in this kind of Yekindar hype. That he is aggressive player. He's a playmaker. He finds gap. He makes a lot of good decisions. But what I found is after he joined Liquid... is Yekindar is a liability more than people realize. He does lose them games. Maybe not so much now that he's calling, but when he did have all his spots, Yekindar would lose them games by getting too aggressive and trying to force the issue too much and trying to be too much of a focal point of that team. And for Yekindar now to be calling, I don't think it's the best use of Yekindar as a player. It doesn't feel right. I don't think it's a coincidence that Yekindar was at his best individually playing for Virtus Pro when he was a secondary voice, very vocal secondary voice, but crucially, he's the explosive, the aggressive part in a passive team. They are perfectly interconnected. You let Yekindar have all the space that injects the explosive element, the unpredictability, and then you have incredible late round calling and team play from Jame and later Flit and you know, even someone like Kicker and Buster when they're at their peaks. You have all these things to round out the lineup. And I'm not sure Liquid going all in on Yekindar as an in-game leader and building completely around him is a good idea or the best use of Yekindar as a player. And I think it might come back to bite them when maybe they should have... Granted, there aren't that many options for in-game leader, but maybe there was a different route to go here and to keep Yekindar in his good roles, not have Patsy in the first place because of the role clashes, and look at a different composition of lineup. So again, the reason I picked them as ugly is I'm not... sure, it's not going to work, actually. I think it could work if Yekindar can transition into his roles and be a more complete caller. But this is, at the moment, is ugly. And there's a lot of clashes here. And it's going to take some figuring out for Liquid. And it's not been the perfect start for them as a lineup.
I'll give my take on Liquid here, which I've kind of made before, which is that it's weird because I think what Liquid's been doing is that they've been more or less preparing themselves for CS2, and what they're doing right now is they're giving Yekindar a lot of runway, because in some ways I wouldn't really expect this lineup to actually deliver on all fronts. I feel like Rainwaker was a bit of a gamble, and Patsy too, just kind of seeing it was just Patsy was available, given that he was getting, I think he was getting benched from Spirit or something like that. And so just looking at those two guys, it's like there's a lot of potential here. Rainmaker was doing decently with that Bulgarian team that he was playing for. And so they probably saw those. They thought, okay, Yekindar, let's lower the expectations on you as an in-game leader because we're going to make this lineup in a way kind of one that can improve. And so what I would love to see from Liquid is that once we get a little bit closer to the prestige events, they trim the fat on this lineup. They see, is Patsy even actually capable of playing with Yekindar? They finally make some of the harder decisions, like should we cut Rainmaker at this point? And if they, because this iteration of, I'll say this, I almost would be shocked if this is the five-man lineup Liquid send to the RMRs when they come for CS2. I don't think that this is likely to be the same roster. And I like that, I don't think it's released yet, but by the time this will release it will have been. Hassan made the ridiculous statement they should get Kay Serato for Rainmaker, which I just think is probably not going to happen just because of contract issues. But a player that is probably a little bit cheaper and I would say could fit Rainwaker's roles and be much better, not as good as Kay Serato, but much better than Rainmaker, is somebody like Mezzi. If you're able to get a Mezzi onto Liquid, I think that this team could do some serious damage because Rainmaker has proven as an individual that he is behind other tier one pros. I think that at the Blast event that he first had his debut with Liquid at, he looked serviceable and he has only gotten worse since then. And it's like when I watch Rainmaker now, I almost am like, how is he going to be a -1 this game, which will look okay, or is he going to be a -8 and be a complete hindrance to them in their achieving their goals? And so I am pretty out on Rainmaker right now. Could be due in part to the fact that the calling style from Yekindar is a little bit awkward. And it's almost like by the time this RMR comes around, I will have expected that a month prior to it, there's a good chance that they'll make one big change, and it could be they just change out Rainmaker for a support player 1-to-1, or they actually take Yekindar off the in-game leader role, keep him on the team, but take Rainmaker off and add a real in-game leader. I think both of those would be serviceable changes for Liquid to make them, and to make like it's all dependent on Yekindar's progress and how much people that are core to the team like Naf and Daps think about Yekindar's calling. If they're not on board with how Yekindar's calling at that point, then I think the GMing will follow suit.
Do you see OC's position as safe now that the team is EU majority? Do you not think that puts him in a lot of jeopardy with the number of good EU AWPers coming through the ranks?
Yeah, I've actually looked at like all the numbers lately, and OC is the weakest AWPer in, say, I think it's top 15, maybe even. So I don't necessarily see why he would stick around if they're looking to switch to that. I don't think his position is safe either. That's why I thought Kassad's move. The one cool thing about Kassad's idea with bringing on Kay Serato is that if you have OC, Naf, and Kay Serato, you're actually an America's roster.
Because remember, it's not just any, and like the RMR would be America, so you could essentially get the easy RMR point, is what you're saying, Alan. So yeah. The spoiler there is, the joke is, though, why the fuck would Kay Serato join this team, you know? And spoiler, I'd like to have access to whatever trade machine Kassad has where you can trade Rainmaker for Prime Kay Serato. Like, again, like, I know Kassad won't know the concept, but like for the NBA and stuff, they have these machines where you can sort of say like what would actually make sense as a trade. That trade makes no sense for anyone, by the way. Like, I don't know who's saying yes to that in any capacity. Right, my biggest problem is this. What actually kills all the interest in Team Liquid for me was that they went EU and then didn't even like go the whole way. Like they do keep OC and they do keep this, like, it's like, bro, the second you remove the shackles of NA, we can have anyone. And aren't we Team Liquid? Are we one like the biggest teams in the world? And also, you look at these players, if you hadn't have changed their roles, bro, if I go to like some really good European, like if I go to Dexter, Wonderful, Zorti, and I say, hey, you can join this lineup. Here's who I'm starting with. I've got Naf and Yekindar in the roles you've already seen them play. Dude, those are awesome players. Yeah, let's do it. When I join a Zorti, a Wonderful, we've got three world-class players already at our roles. Instead, you've kept Dorsey, who, by the way, as these Russian players who were insane with the AWP come online, he's just getting worse and worse and further down the pack. Like every name I just listed, even Zorti, you'd take him immediately. You'd gamble on that as the upgrade. Like, so not only did you like keep an underwhelming player as your AWPer, Then you fucked with your IGL. So now, like, look, people might have been out on Nitro. He still had a very stable style of calling that worked. It clearly was understandable. Meanwhile, you go and look at some of these interviews. Go look at this interview last week with Patsy that was done on HLTV. It's a bloody nightmare, but he thinks he's given straight fire answers. Like, they ask him, like, what percentage do you think you can effectively communicate in English? He says 50%.
Oh, my God.
Like, I know he might be doing that thing that everyone does who's a foreign speaker. Like, you know, I speak bad English. Meanwhile, they're like some Swede fucking like perfectly like conjugating all the verbs and everything. And you're like, you really don't speak bad English. But I get what they mean. They mean like, I know that you're better than me, basically. I don't even think he's being humble. I think he's probably telling the truth. I think this is a guy who probably didn't have to speak English almost in any context. And I'm sure he just knows basic FPL callouts. Like, also, here's a really alarming sign. He not only says he speaks 50%, Alan, but then he quickly explains it's okay, though, because Yekindar can translate. Like, what are you talking about? No, bro. There's no translation in the game. Like, that's not a thing. Like, we can do that in a review. Yeah, I'm with you. Like, and even then, it's going to be a bit awkward. Like pausing while he translates. In the game, there's no translation. Forget about that. Like, remember that line that Yanko told me in that interview? Like, a good call, a second late becomes a bad call. What the fuck do you think it becomes 5 seconds later? What are you even talking about? Like, you can't even make a call. So, by the way, God bless trying to fucking mid-round when you're going to play and doesn't even fully understand the language you're mid-grounded in. And then if you look at the players, like I said there, the real thing I hate is that they gave up certain things to become a U, but they didn't benefit that much from it. Like, essentially, you became a U to get Rain Waker. That's it. You gambled it all to get Rain Waker. For Rain Waker. The reason why that sucks, like I say, is what did you give up? You even gave up the most obvious pieces, like Naf and Yekindar in their previous roles were world class. Like, the joke is Patsy's actually a worse version of fucking Yekindar. Maybe without the ego, I don't know. But it's just, like, I actually like Patsy as well. I'm with you, Alan. The problem is, though, like, if the question is, do I want Patsy? Yes. Well, you didn't let me answer there. He has to replace Yekindar, and then Yekindar becomes the... Well, then no. The answer's obviously no to that one, isn't it? Like, because the problem there is, this is why it is all about Yekindar. That only seems like an upside if you think Yekindar's going to be an awesome IGL. And the problem is, as far as I can tell, and I notice this is very interesting, dude, loads of people love Yekindar as a player. A lot of talent like him. Have you noticed how there's no one out there making bold predictions about how awesome Liquid's going to be or how he's definitely going to make it inside? Nobody seems to have this take. Even the people who like him don't seem... Everyone seems a bit confused. Like, I don't know, bro. Like, I mean, you can give it a go, but I don't know if it's going to... He seems to think it's the future. I don't. And so to me, you've ruined the style of the team by taking Yekindar off. Like, that was a slam dunk player. Yeah, as you pointed out, Alan, if you're trying to make him the best player in the world, there's definitely negatives and there's definitely times he cost you the game. But if you put him as like a role player in a really good team, it could be fucking winning the major tomorrow. He's that level. So you've already limited yourself there. And then after all these issues we're talking about, then you look down and then, like you say, Aussie, what are you still doing here, bro? We went EU. Like, you know, it's about 100 AWP. Give me a break. So the joke is I don't even have to get to Rain Waker. Rain Waker's at the end of all this. Like, Rain Waker, as far as I can tell, his job is just being like a shitty support player that they scouted. But again, it's like we said about the other lines, the game allegiance. If you don't take care of the top part of the game, then I'll explain it this way. In general, I conceive of role players as like rounding out a lineup, setting up a player. What is there to set up? You have to have the star players. Like, yeah, that's why I say, in theory, every lineup starts with the stars. Then you figure out, are these pieces good enough to make it work? You can't have, like, pieces around them and then not the stars, because this lineup is going to have the same problem. I've seen them play enough games now. It's going to be the exact same problem the last lineup had, which is you are not going to get the games from Naf that you think you are to carry the win. He's not that player. One thing about Naf for me is, in my opinion, he's like the most overqualified, like, supportive element in Counter-Strike right now. He's not the guy who's going to drop a 1.3 rating and carry the whole fucking series. In fact, the saddest thing is, I'll even give what I think's the nail in the coffin, which is, even though Yekindar definitely is way worse as an IGL, he still does, to his credit, have the odd map where he just pops off, and it's like the old... Bro, they still barely win then. That's not even like a... Like, think about this. Think about any other great in-game leader where you actually value their in-game leading. If they can ever have like a 27-14 game, dude, that's a game, that's like a 16-8. We're out of here. Let's fucking go home. Dude, this is like, he has to do that for them to occasionally get the map three. Like, what? So I have to say, I get like everyone was hyped off that initial blast. It's like a classic blast fool's gold of like you started the season strong. Mate, that was it. That was like, that was the fucking peak and everything's been down since then. Like, I'm actually kind of bummed out about this lineup. Like, I'll always give a lot of leeway to people like Daps. I think they actually have a very good eye for the game. But I do think, like, They're actually lucky, by the way, there isn't a major in like 2 months. If there was, this lineup like dies if it doesn't do something that major. Like, I don't see what the future is of this team. And like I say, the real killer is, because it's an EU team now, it's just necessary. You could have these players. Surely these players want to join Team Liquid. Come on. I don't get it, mate. I don't get it myself. I think it's whack.
Yeah. Yeah. Come on, then, I could go to my ugly here. Mine is that it's the way, so let's just put this out there. NIP right now is in a horrible state. And what I want to talk about isn't actually NIP.
Do you know what's brilliant? Right, I'll let you make your point, but at the end, I've got a really funny comedy piece, though, in light of the show that we did yesterday and the one that we're doing now, though. Basically, you can look this up while we're talking now if you want, but essentially, I've never seen this before. Launders just did an interview for Blast where he actually says, like, he says the line that NIP might win a tournament. For real. You can look and go look on Blast.tv. Just go look. Anyway, make your point. But I want everyone to check it out while we're all doing this. Look on Blast. It was on like the last week or something, or recently. I'll have a look. I'll see if I can link it to you, actually.
Okay. Well, my point is that what I find really frustrating is when I watch head trick games or read comments about our NIP games, and I read the comments in like post game threads, whatever, just even like HLTV forum titles and things like that, and even just kind of even somewhat I think the pundits in this space have overrated him is his head trick's numbers are so inflated that everybody is on this like save head trick type tip, and I'm just kind of, when I watch very closely and in the games live, and which I've done on my stream, like where I'm just only focusing on head trick for rounds at a time, I'm basically trying to demonstrate and show to everybody, like, no, guys, Hedrick's rating is so good because he takes up one spot at the beginning of a round with the op. He doesn't rotate, and so what happens is that he'll either get the kill as someone walks into his crosshair, and then he'll just get that one, sometimes even misses it, by the way, and then he'll save. Because Hedrick has to be one of the least active oppers I see right now in Tier 1, and that makes his rating is incredibly strong. Like, it's way too good for what he is doing in the server. It's just that his DPR, his deaths per round, is so low. So that's something that's really concerning when people, like, Hedrick, for example, had the third lowest deaths per round at the ESL Pro League group that he just played. The only people with lower DPR were Device and BlameF, and the people that are around him are other bona fide stars. Zywoo, K-Serato, Majisk. Like, those are the people that are surrounding Hedrick for DPR, and those guys are all playing for winning teams, more or less. Like, sure, K-Serato is not necessarily playing for the most winning team, but he's definitely playing for... He's definitely good enough that his DPR makes sense. But when you look at Hedrick's DPR, he saves so much more than every other opera I watch right now. And I am including Shiro in this list right now. I am... Like, Hedrick plays the most passive style of opping from anybody not named Jame. Like, I actually think he is more passive than Shiro. And so his number gets so crazily inflated because when you actually look at, like, KPR, the kill per round type stat...
Oh, it's never that high. It's never that high.
Yeah, his KPR is not that good. Like, his KPR is around people like Kiaz and Acor and Buzz. So it's just that his numbers get so... His rating gets so inflated. That's why I'm on still the biggest crusade to not just look at a person's rating and judge them based off of that, because it's so obvious that when you play for rating like Hedrick has been, it's not that I don't actually think Hedrick is consciously connecting to the server saying I will play for rating, but he is saying I am going to stay alive. I am not going to die. I don't want to die. And that in turn inflates your rating, like what it does for people like Jame, where Jame got to be 10th in the world or whatever that 1 year for HLTV, but it's like you look at his impact in the server, and he's not the 10th most impactful player when we're watching all these tier 1 games, which we do. So that's my main concern, is that people think that Hedrick, like that Hedrick, basically they think that NIP is failing despite Hedrick doing his absolute damnedest to lift this team up. He's not. He's frankly not. If you watch a Hedrick demo, you'll see that he just sits in the same spot for the entire round. And I don't dislike Hedrick. I think that people also really get on me because I jump on players that are quiet. It's not like I dislike Hedrick. I just think the way that his style is one that is so prone to have community perception overrate him tremendously.
Yeah, I mean, my kind of rough take on Hedrick is that He comes into the team. He has a lot of teething problems. Presumably at the start they did. Not to say he's close to the same level, but like Munizzi is a model of how you bring in a player and you give them space and opportunities, and then it doesn't work. And I'm guessing he kind of gets to this position in his play style at the moment because here, Hampus or Alexi at the time or DGL step in as these leaders over him. They say, what is the most effective way to use this player with the skill set he has, with where he is even as a person when he comes into a team being such a young player, so inexperienced? Maybe that is the most effective way to use him as a player. But I mean, I think all of us just look at this NiP lineup and just say, what are we trying to achieve here? What is the point? And the way I like to look at this NiP team is actually going back to the decision of going international and that move and that and going that direction. And if you want to look at Hedrick as a player and not say he's bad, but the problem is, if we're going to be an international team and we're going to not use a Swedish AWPer or at least Scandinavian, is Hedrick the player that we insert in there? Do we take this communication sacrifice for the sake of Hedrick? And the answer is no. Hedrick might work on another team. Hedrick might play even better, I guess. He play speaking in his native tongue as well. But Hedrick on this lineup just doesn't make sense. And something I enjoyed the most about Apex playing well is just Nork being back in good form and NiP having to watch him play well and saying, if only we just held on to this player and had a decent Swedish AWPer, where we could have been as a team. So, I mean, that's the way I like to look at NIP is, I actually admire them taking the decision to go international because they were a little bit hard capped. But with the way the lineup is at the moment, and especially with Hedrick in that AWPing position, it just doesn't ring of a situation that's going to improve or get better or there's got a lot of upside. So Hedrick's not a bad player, but there definitely are better options. And if I was NiP, I'd either upgrade him or go back to the next best Swedish or maybe Norwegian or Danish AWPer and try and speak in Swedish because I don't think this is worth it for this team. And I think ultimately, if you look at their objective of going international, it's failed. And they are actually in a worse position than they were with those old Swedish teams.
The problem with the Hedrick angle, in my opinion, Maui, is narratively he is set up to garner a lot of sympathy and sentiment because he's a Ukrainian player who switches to an international team made of bloody Nordic players at that as well, by the way. So if people don't get it, their level of English is going to be so much better than yours. Like he may as well just be playing with native English speakers. Like I think Swedish players have the best English of anyone in the world. I mean, we talked about this on the other show, but it's just true. Like they have phenomenal English. So the gap, it's not like you're just playing with other players from CIS plus a couple of like foreign players. No, you're going to a scenario where the joke is their second language English is probably too good for you. So already you're like, fucking hell, he's facing a hard time. Then you find out that info. A lot of us didn't even find out till he started playing, which is, oh, by the way, he isn't even an AWPer. He's just switched to be an AWPer. Almost like some sort of, like, I'll give you the analogy, right? One of the things they do here in the Netherlands, Alan, where I live now, which reminds me of the UK, is they have this really weird thing where you get pizza shops and kebab shops, but they do that thing where instead of just having like pizzas, you have a menu of like 100 things and you also make like a burger and you'll make, and you just think like, bro, no one's coming to your pizza shop to buy a burger. Like you go to a burger to essentially, like the joke there is you get the vibe because they are literally tend to be owned by like some cynical old like Turkish guy. It's almost like he's just saying like, if you got any money, right? What do you want? I'll make whatever it is. Like, I just want the money, basically. That feels like what they did with Hedrick. They were like, right, what are you looking for? They were like, oh, we want like an up and coming, like young player with prospect. Yeah, we've got those. Yeah. Kind of like Monacy or Simple or Wonderful. Ah, shit, we've already sold those. But tell you what, Hedrick, can you warp, mate? I mean, I could give it a go. Yeah, I've got one of those. Yeah, got another Monacy in the back, actually. Let me just check. Like, oh, you won't believe it. Hasn't even got out the box yet. Yeah, you can have him. Because the most criminal part is, I tried searching now, I couldn't find the number. But if you remember the rumors at the time as well, what was it? It was like half the Monacy buyout. The rumor was it was like a 300K or 250K buyout. That's the most criminal part. Because when you hear that, they set this guy up for failure. They put him into a scenario where essentially he was billed as this is Monacy. And then you get him and you're like, well, there's only one Monacy, isn't there? So he isn't, like, he's not close. So the problem is, not only is he, like, in a tough spot language-wise, but then also, essentially, he's doing the man too. He has to change from rifle to AWP. And he has to do it, by the way, hit the ground running at tier one on LAN. Like, how much more hard do you want to make this guy's life? Like, what next? Are we just going to, like, speed the movie, put, like, a bomb in his heart, and if he drops below a certain amount of kills, his just head blows off his wing? What are we doing here? So in that scenario, Maui, our poor Fedrick, I'm like, fuck, I hope this guy can make it. I hope he can battle these scenarios. The problem is, that's not how you analyze Counter-Strike. You're supposed to actually take all that shit out of the equation, just look in the server and go, is this player competent enough? And the real problem is this, he is not a bad player in any context. I actually think if you look at him, he did get better and better and better as he played for Nip. But you are right, he has never come close to touching the sides of being a Monacy, a Wonderful, a Zod. These players are levels above. And as you say, his numbers with the AWP, they aren't the star numbers. He's not actually playing like a carry role. Like, he's not like Dexter in OG, where he would frag the fuck out and they'd lose the game. Essentially, within a losing game, he's just carving out some kills and he's just surviving, basically, Maui. He's just surviving at the moment and keep going. And spoiler, not only... I mean, I don't think personally, long term, I think there is a chance to try a Swedish lineup. But even if they don't, you don't stick with this player anyway. Like, logically to me, he needs to go back to the CIS region, or he needs to go to a different team and be a rifler. One of the two. Like, I wouldn't keep him as an AWPer. He never looked that comfortable with the AWP as well. As in, he can kill people. But to me, this is why people who are secondary AWPers usually make a mistake if they become a primary. That's not AWPing. AWPing is when you're having a shit game and a shit half and you're getting beaten up and you have to still go into some like nightmare choke angle and hold it and know that you will hit that first shot. And unless you're world class, that doesn't happen. Like, I mean, surely everyone's had a bad game. When you have a bad game with the AWP, it's the worst bad game because you hit nothing. You don't get any kill. You're not on a rifle where you put two bullets in him still. You'll get nothing. You get actually nothing out of the game. So it's that's why I always say make or break. Tier 1 AWP is the hardest role to play in Counter-Strike. And all this guy, like, I agree, he's not bad, but he's also not a star. And they clearly need a star in fucking Nip as well. Like, I think essentially it's a waste of time, this project. Just a waste of everyone. Because yeah, here's the difference. You're right on the numbers as well. The numbers are deceptive. You go look now on HLTV and you only look at the kills and the deaths. Dude, his numbers are almost the same as Zorte, Sun Pius. But I tell you what, the eye test doesn't check out. Like, those players are incredibly impactful.
I think even for the, I'm sure there is a fan base of Hedrick and Nip, especially given, you know, the Ukraine situation, that look at us saying stuff like, you know, he shouldn't be on this team, or like, he's not actually that good of a player relative to how he's rated and whatever. And the important point is that we're almost batting for Hedrick. We're saying, this is not a good situation for this player. This isn't the right team for him. He should be on a Monty. He should be on maybe a Gamer Legion, these sort of teams, and play naturally through the scene. How many times do you see players thrown in at the top level, have problems, maybe even off the back of, you know, poor communication and not be able to switch the language, these sort of things, and then immediately get outcast because everyone's like, oh, he just can't play, he's not good, because he's been elevated too fast. So I think that's a really important point here, is that, you know, it might sound like we're bagging on Hedrick. We're just saying, this is not the right team for this player. Maybe he shouldn't even be playing in a top 15 sort of level just yet. And he would, for the sake of his career, be better on a different team. It would be better, definitely, for sure.
Right, let's do it then. It's the last one. Mate, mine is actually going to be one where I can't believe this has gone under the radar. I'm so triggered by this. I almost put it as my bad point, but I realized it has to stay as the ugly because there's still a positive. Dude, you know, most people aren't aware that Jerry is now going to be in a brand new team not called Fours. But we had to wait until fucking 2023 when CSGO is ending. And when I say a new team, oh, don't worry, it's not Cloud9, Narvi, it's not any of the teams you'd want. So we've been waiting for this motherfucker to get out of prison for like 7 years. That's an extension, but 5 years. 5 years, every single analyst ever has gone, which CIS IGL should they get? What about Jerry? What about Jerry? What about Jerry? Well, and then everyone goes, well, of course, he can't leave Fours, can he? So that's not really on. Turns out he can at the end. And it's just, it sounds like for real, if you go read this interview with him, bro, he's just going to be on a team like with Fours level players again. He's just going to go and get up and comers and try and grind. He's like, bloody hell. Now you see why I picked it as an ugly. When we were all talking about this Cloud9 lineup, which already looks great. Mate, if Jerry is inserted and you kick out Hobbit and you just make Electronic another entry player, that becomes what all the potential, all the dream is. Like, that is suddenly the team that, hey, they could be number one with this squad. Like, the idea that you have all these squads out there, to this day, If I said to one of you right now, like, gun to your head, really quickly, name three good CISI GLs. Bro, if you even get to two, I'll give you a bonus fucking brownie point. Like, give me a break. If there's one thing their region lacks, it's IGLs. They have mega rifles and AWPs. They have almost every role except IGL. And then this guy is not only leaving for us, but he's just going to go to some other bum-ass team. That just sucks, dude. Like, what a wasted career this player has had. It's not like I'm saying, here's the one thing I won't say. Because I've never seen him actually IGL like a truly world-class team, I can't know that he would have done it. But the what if just kills me, especially now I know sort of it was possible to leave the team. Now this feel, I'll tie it into what we said earlier. It's like the Furia point earlier. It would be like if in a year from now, Keserato does just leave Furia and join like some international team, but he joins like Mouse, and you're like, wait a minute, it was possible for you to leave the whole time. You know, I could have got you in like Vitality or FaZe. Nah, it's all right, bro. I'm in Mouse. That like, give me a break. Like, what a wasted opportunity for everyone. Doesn't that tilt you, that information, Mark? So it's on anyone's radar. No one knows this. Like, dude, he's actually leaving. What?
Yeah. Dude, I didn't even know this was happening, actually.
I just saw, like, an interview on some site somewhere when I was, like, reading some other news. I was like, what?
Yeah. I didn't even know he left. I didn't even know he left for
I believe he got benched, but who knows what bench means in the modern world? You know, that might be, like, voluntary. Yeah. Who knows? Who even knows what
happened? I mean, I just remember so vividly the way that it was on, like, the Flashpoint interview you guys did with, I forgot, it was you, probably Monty, and, I mean, it was probably you, Monty, and Jerry, I think, where you guys talked about the idea of him playing for another roster, and he was like, he was just like, no, there's no reason I would do that, or something like that. And it was
he made
like,
it unironically sound like he was a medieval serf, Alan, and he, like, enjoyed living on the master's land, as it were. It sounded mental the way he phrased it. He almost made it sound like he would, like, I think he even did say something, didn't he, Maui, like, that he'd thought about it, but then he had to, like, check himself because of how, like, unacceptable it would be for, like, him to leave us. And you're like, what? Yeah. What sort of mad career have you got? What?
I considered it, then I had to flay myself for even thinking about that.
It's like, it's so weird.
Yeah, but with Jerry,
like, he's just flagellating himself every night, like, oh, joining Na'Vi, no, never, be pure, like,
he's the reek. I can't handle it. Going on with Forza right there. What's crazy is that I almost in some ways kind of stopped entertaining conversations about even theory crafting where Jerry could go, and more so started thinking like, what about like Boomage coming back?
Exactly.
What about Chopper? Because it's just like, well, it never
just
I
seems
never
more plausible, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see what Jerry's able to do, because he's already shown with multiple Forza lineups that he can bring up young rising talent.
Absolutely.
In the Eastern Europe region and actually make them competitive, like top 25 at the very least. So I want to see if he can keep doing that. I'm curious where he's going to land. Like, did this article say anything about his upcoming team? Because if he does it again, like, this guy might be one of the most impressive in-game leaders out there right now.
Oh, actually, this interview, by the way, came out today. It's on HLTV. Oh. The headline says, "You will find out about my new roster on September 15th. So I guess we don't know until then.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I didn't see this today. Yeah, okay, sure. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, the main ugly thing about it, obviously, is that it got to a point where I stopped entertaining even the idea of him leaving, because it was just like, it's never going to happen. I felt like it was like a 10-year contract or something like that. But, like, it would have been cool to think about, would Jerry have been the answer for Cloud9 back when I was having all of my criticisms for Nafany? I just think of, like, there's so many rosters in the past 4 years from Eastern Europe where it was like, could Jerry have been the solution? And we never got to see any of those materialize. So it's a huge what if Jerry had a more lenient contract, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to look at Jerry is, yes, he has taken similar sort of makeup lineups in terms of, you know, being younger players and got them back up to, I don't know, let's say a top 15 level, at least competitive in terms of on the fringes of the big events and always playing on the edge of playing in majors. But I think another way to actually think about it is he gets up to that level with those initial Forza teams, and then he doesn't have a career progression beyond that. He stays at a similar level for a long time. Yes, he puts in a lot of good work. But in terms of Jerry developing as a player and as a person, as an in-game leader, I'm not convinced it could have happened that well, because he consistently loses his best players to the top teams, and he himself doesn't get the jump up to play in, you know, with better players, under a better coach, under a better organization. So I think that's the really sad part, is that Jerry might have missed the boat to grow up, you know, the way that like Gambit youngsters grew up into Gambit and became, you know, an elite level team, and some of those players now regard some as the best in the world. Jerry never got the chance to play on a lineup like that and grow up through the scene and develop as a player. Maybe can still do that, but he has missed out on a lot of good, talented players from that region. The Spirit teams, the even Entropic, these sort of lineups with really good players. Jerry never got his chance to play on these teams and to have a really good lineup around him. And I think it is just sad. I will say that, at least in terms of recent history, when I think it was Fierce joined as coach of Forza, I was a bit alarmed by the fact that Jerry was saying he was still learning a lot in terms of how to call and how to run these rounds and how to mid round properly and how to manage his emotions and all these sort of things. I would have thought he might be more developed as a leader, but I think that's more a consequence of him just not playing at a higher level and not getting that experience and not getting these opportunities. So, yeah, as we said, some sort of contract hell, some sort of deal with the devil. And he missed a shot. I mean, and another factor obviously is, you know, for a player from Russia now, it's more difficult to, let's say, move around and play on different teams. What if Jerry's got pretty decent English? What if he could have gone to an NA team in 2019 and just played with some of those good, you know, good younger players?
By the way, he's an obvious name. If we knew it was available, I'd be throwing him in the liquid mix. Like, imagine him with Naf and Yekindar. Like, give me now we're cooking with gas, boys.
Yeah, so it's just, I mean, the whole scenario around Jerry is just a little bit sad that we never got to find out where he could have been and what he could have grown into. And I'm not. I think he has been overrated by a lot of people for quite a long time. In
It's
terms
like
of
I
saying
say though, it's because
he could,
there's just no IGL, so everyone just goes for that one name every time.
The idea that he could go in tomorrow and make a Cloud9 incredible is probably false. But the idea that he could grow into being a really good in-game leader if he had the opportunities is potentially true. And we never got the answers to that. And maybe he can do it now, but given the world scenario, given that it seems unlikely he's going to be at the helm of a big project, it's not going to be soon. So, I mean, if there's one good thing, hopefully he just doesn't sign a contract for more than a year, let's be honest. And if he does play this lineup into a good place, he can get poached,
By
because
the way,
that is probably best case scenario.
one way I will say he probably was overrated is because if you actually look, I don't think a lot of people love this. Dude, he's 25 now. He only just turned 25 like in May this year. So that means when he was on that Forza team back at like Epicenter, that means he was like fucking 20 or 21 years old or something. Like, it actually means, if anything, he was a very young guy who committed to being an IGL and has done it a number of years now. And that's why the real sad thing is, first of all, we've already seen with Snappy and Carrigan, like, if you're actually a great IGL, dude, you can play in your 30s. Like, so in theory, it shouldn't even be over. Like, he's got all these years ahead of him. But if he ends up going, like I say, to the same level or worse of just some no-name team that's like Forza 2.0, then it's just like, what are we doing here? Like, what's the point? Because the other sad thing is, like I say before, like, by the way, when I make those arguments, every bloody hot take point made, like, why isn't Snappy on G2? I'm not saying he definitely do it, but the point is, like, essentially, when you've done that much to a certain level, like Alan's talking about, it almost necessitates you at least get a chance. I'd give the example as a player of like Saifon Payne. That guy was so hard carrying every fucking game. He had to get a chance at AWPing at a top level. Yeah, maybe it didn't work out. Maybe they didn't give him the spot, whatever. But yeah, it wasn't wrong to give him the try. So the same thing, the idea no one ever tried Jerry, that's the part I can't abide by. If you just tried and failed, whatever. But the idea you're going to blow 5 years and then now might be even more years just on like tier two and the nightmares you can never get past tier 1.5. Like, that just feels a bit whack, as I say, in a region that actually this is the most thin on the ground position they have. Like, the joke is, if you take him out of the equation, you actually are unironically like some Sophie's Choice shit. Like, right, who do we want then? Do we want Nafani, Boomich, or Chopper? It's like, is there any 1v1 game I can go and play? Like, what are we doing here? Like, that's our choices. That's the three choices we have. Like, it's hard. All I'm gonna say, Alan, is it's hard not to overrate someone when that's your quite. Oh, Nealon, remember to put Nealon in the game. I think in general we learn from this episode every CIS IGL just overrated as fuck in it. Just game over.
Jame is good.
That's true. I always forget about that. It's true. I always forget. Yeah, you're right. Actually, Jame is a really good IGL. That's true. But then again, obviously he's not leaving, is he? So he's just staying there forever.